Section 21 of the Iliad by Homer, translated by Samuel Butler. Book 21. The fight between Achilles and the river Scamander. The gods fight among themselves. Achilles drives the Trojans within their gates. Now when they came to the ford of the full-flowing river Xanthius, begotten of immortal Jove, Achilles cut their forces in two. One half he chased over the plain towards the city by the same way that the Achaeans had taken when flying panic-stricken on the preceding day with Hector in full triumph. This way did they fly pell-mell, and Juno sent down a thick mist in front of them to stay them. The other half were hemmed in by the deep, silver-eddying stream, and fell into it with a great uproar. The waters resounded, and the banks rang again as they swam hither and thither with loud cries amid the whirling eddies. As locusts flying to a river before the blast of a grass fire, the flame comes on and on till at last it overtakes them and they huddle into the water. Even so was the eddying stream of Xanthus filled with the uproar of men and horses, all struggling in confusion before Achilles. Forthwith the hero left his spear upon the bank, leaning it against a tamarisk bush, and plunged into the river like a god, armed with his sword only. Fell was his purpose as he hewed the Trojans down on every side. Their dying groans rose hideous as the sword smote them, and the river ran red with blood. As when fish fly, scared before a huge dolphin, and fill every nook and corner of some fair haven, for he is sure to eat all he can catch. Even so did the Trojans cower under the banks of the mighty river. And when Achilles' arms grew weary from killing them, he drew 12 youths alive out of the water to sacrifice in revenge for Patroclus, son of Menoetius. He drew them out like dazed fawns, bound their hands behind them with the girdles of their own shirts, and gave them over to his men to take back to the ships. Then he sprang into the river, thirsting for still further blood. There he found Lycaon, son of Priam, seed of Dardanus, as he was escaping out of the water. He it was whom he had once taken prisoner when he was in his father's vineyard, having set upon him by night as he was cutting young shoots from a wild fig tree to make the wicker sides of a chariot. Achilles then caught him to his sorrow unawares, and sent him by sea to Lemnos, where the son of Jason bought him. But a guest friend, Eetion of Imbros, freed him with a great sum and sent him to Arisbe, whence he had escaped and returned to his father's house. He had spent 11 days happily with his friends after he had come from Lemnos, but on the 12th heaven again delivered him into the hands of Achilles, who was to send him to the house of Hades sorely against his will. He was unarmed when Achilles caught sight of him, and had neither helmet nor shield, nor yet had he any spear, for he had thrown all his armour from him onto the bank, and was sweating with his struggles to get out of the river, so that his strength was now failing him. Then Achilles said to himself in his surprise, "What marvel do I see here? If this man can come back alive after having been sold over into Lemnos, I shall have the Trojans also, whom I have slain, rising from the world below. Could not even the waters of the grey sea imprison him, as they do many another, whether he will or no? This time let him taste my spear, that I may know for certain whether Mother Earth, who can keep even a strong man down, will be able to hold him, or whether thence too he will return." Thus did he pause and ponder. But Lycaon came up to him dazed, and trying hard to embrace his knees, for he would fain live, not die. Achilles thrust at him with his spear, meaning to kill him, but Lycaon ran crouching up to him and caught his knees, whereby the spear passed over his back and stuck in the ground, hungering though it was for blood. With one hand he caught Achilles' knees as he besought him, and with the other he clutched the spear and would not let it go. Then he said, "Achilles, have mercy upon me and spare me, for I am your suppliant. It was in your tents that I first broke bread on the day when you took me prisoner in the vineyard, after which you sold me away to Lemnos, far from my father and my friends, and I brought you the price of 100 oxen. I have paid 3 times as much to gain my freedom. It is but 12 days that I have come to Ilius after much suffering, and now cruel fate has again thrown me into your hands. Surely Father Jove must hate me that he has given me over to you a second time. Short of life indeed did my mother Laothoe bear me, daughter of aged Altes, of Altes, who reigns over the warlike Lelegi and holds steep Badaeus on the river Satnioeus. Priam married his daughter along with many other women, and two sons were born of her, both of whom you will have slain. Your spear slew noble Polydorus as he was fighting in the front ranks, and now evil will here befall me, for I fear that I shall not escape you, since heaven has delivered me over to you. Furthermore, I say, and lay my saying to your heart, spare me, for I am not of the same womb as Hector, who slew your brave and noble comrade. With such words did the princely son of Priam beseech Achilles, but Achilles answered him sternly. Idiot, he said, talk not to me of ransom. Until Patroclus fell, I preferred to give the Trojans quarter, and sold beyond the sea many of those whom I had taken alive. But now not a man shall live of those whom heaven delivers into my hands before the city of Ilius, and of all Trojans it shall fare hardest with the sons of Priam. Therefore, my friend, you too shall die. Why should you whine in this way? Patroclus fell, and he was a better man than you are. I, too, see you not how I am great and goodly? I am son to a noble father, and of a goddess for my mother, but the hands of doom and death overshadow me all as surely. The day will come, either at dawn or dark, or at the noontide, when one shall take my life also in battle, either with his spear or with an arrow sped from his bow. Thus did he speak, and Lycaon's heart sank within him. He loosed his hold of the spear and held out both hands before him, but Achilles drew his keen blade and struck him by the collarbone on his neck. He plunged his two-edged sword into him to the very hilt, whereon he lay at full length on the ground, with the dark blood welling from him till the earth was soaked. Then Achilles caught him by the foot and flung him into the river to go downstream, vaunting over him the while and saying, "Lie there among the fishes who will lick the blood from your wound and gloat over it. Your mother shall not lay you on any bier to mourn you, but the eddies of Scamander shall bear you into the broad bosom of the sea. There shall the fishes feed on the fat of Lycaon as they dart under the dark ripple of the waters. So perish all of you till we reach the citadel of strong Ilius, you in flight and I following after to destroy you. The river with its broad silver stream shall serve you in no stead, for all the bulls you offered him and all the horses that you flung living into his waters. None the less miserably shall you perish, till there is not a man of you but is paid in full for the death of Patroclus and the havoc you wrought among the Achaeans whom you have slain while I held aloof from battle." So spoke Achilles, but the river grew more and more angry, and pondered within himself how he should stay the hand of Achilles and save the Trojans from disaster. Meanwhile the son of Peleus, spear in hand, sprang upon Asteropaeus, son of Pelagon, to kill him. He was son to the broad river Axius and Peribaea, eldest daughter of Asamoneus, for the river had laid with her. Asteropaeus stood up out of the water to face him with a spear in either hand, and Xanthus filled him with courage, being angry for the death of the youths whom Achilles was slaying ruthlessly within his waters. When they were close up with one another, Achilles was first to speak. "Who and whence are you," said he, "who dare to face me? Woe to the parent whose son stands up against me." And the son of Pelagon answered, "Great son of Peleus, why should you ask my lineage? I am from the fertile land of far Paeonia, captain of the Paeonians, and it is now 11 days that I am at Ilius. I am of the blood of the river Axius, of Axius that is the fairest of all rivers that run. He begot the famed warrior Pelagon, whose son men call me. Let us now fight, Achilles." Thus did he defy him, and Achilles raised his spear of Pelian ash. Asteropaeus failed with both his spears, for he could use both hands alike. With the one spear he struck Achilles' shield, but did not pierce it, for the layer of gold, gift of the god, stayed the point. With the other spear he grazed the elbow of Achilles' right arm, drawing dark blood, but the spear itself went by him and fixed itself in the ground, foiled of its bloody banquet. Then Achilles, fain to kill him, hurled his spear at Asteropaeus, but failed to hit him, and struck the steep bank of the river, driving the spear half its length into the earth. The son of Peleus then drew his sword and sprang furiously upon him. Asteropaeus vainly tried to draw Achilles' spear out of the bank by main force, Thrice did he tug at it, trying with all his might to draw it out, and thrice he had to leave off trying. The fourth time he tried to bend and break it, but ere he could do so, Achilles smote him with his sword and killed him. He struck him in the belly near the navel, so that all his bowels came gushing out onto the ground, and the darkness of death came over him as he lay gasping. Then Achilles set his foot on his chest and spoiled him of his armour, vaunting over him and saying, "Lie there, begotten of a river though you be. It is hard for you to strive with the offspring of Saturn's son. You declare yourself sprung from the blood of a broad river, but I am of the seed of mighty Jove. My father is Peleus, son of Asus, ruler over the many Myrmidons, and Asus was the son of Jove. Therefore, as Jove is mightier than any river that flows into the sea, so are his children stronger than those of any river whatsoever. Moreover, you have a great river hard by, if he can be of any use to you, but there is no fighting against Jove, the son of Saturn, with whom not even King Achelous can compare, nor the mighty stream of deep-flowing Oceanus, from whom all rivers and seas, with all springs and deep wells, proceed. Even Oceanus fears the lightnings of great Jove, and his thunder that comes crashing out of heaven." With this he drew his bronze spear out of the bank, and now that he had killed Asteropaeus, he let him lie where he was on the sand, with the dark water flowing over him, and the eels and fishes busy nibbling and gnawing the fat that was about his kidneys. Then he went in chase of the Paeonians, who were flying along the bank of the river in panic when they saw their leader slain by the hands of the son of Peleus. Therein he slew Thersilochus, Mydon, Astypylus, Mnesus, Thrasius, Oeneus, and Ophelestes, and he would have slain yet others, had not the river in anger taken human form and spoken to him from out of the deep waters, saying, "Achilles, if you exceed all in strength, so do you also in wickedness, for the gods are ever with you to protect you. If then the son of Saturn has vouchsafed it to you to destroy all the Trojans, at any rate drive them out of my stream, and do your grim work on land. My fair waters are now filled with corpses, nor can I find any channel by which I may pour myself into the sea, for I am choked with dead, and yet you go on mercilessly slaying. I am in despair, therefore, O captain of your host, trouble me no further." Achilles answered, "So be it, Scamander," Jove descended, "but I will never cease dealing out death among the Trojans till I have pent them up in their city and made trial of Hector face to face, that I may learn whether he is to vanquish me or I him." As he spoke, he set upon the Trojans with a fury like that of the gods. But the river said to Apollo, "Surely, son of Jove, lord of the silver bow, you are not obeying the commands of Jove, who charged you straitly that you should stand by the Trojans and defend them till twilight fades and darkness is over the earth." Meanwhile Achilles sprang from the bank into midstream, whereon the river raised a high wave and attacked him. He swelled his stream into a torrent and swept away the many dead whom Achilles had slain and left within his waters. These he cast out onto the land, bellowing like a bull the while, but the living he saved alive, hiding them in his mighty eddies. The great and terrible wave gathered about Achilles, falling upon him and beating on his shield so that he could not keep his feet. He caught hold of a great elm tree, but it came up by the roots and tore away the bank, damming the stream with its thick branches and bridging it all across, whereby Achilles struggled out of the stream and fled full speed over the plain, for he was afraid. But the mighty god ceased not in his pursuit, and sprang upon him with a dark crested wave to stay his hands and save the Trojans from destruction. The son of Peleus darted away a spear's throw from him, swift as the swoop of a black hunter eagle, which is the strongest and fleetest of all birds. Even so did he spring forward, and the armour rang loudly about his breast. He fled on in front, but the river with a loud roar came tearing after. As one who would water his garden leads a stream from some fountain over his plants and all his ground, spade in hand he clears away the dams to free the channels, and the little stones run rolling round and round with the water as it goes merrily down the bank faster than the man can follow. Even so did the river keep catching up with Achilles, albeit he was a fleet runner, for the gods are stronger than men. as often as he would strive to stand his ground and see whether or no all the gods in heaven were in league against him, so often would the mighty wave come beating down upon his shoulders, and he would have to keep flying on and on in great dismay, for the angry flood was tiring him out as it flowed past him and ate the ground from under his feet. Then the son of Peleus lifted up his voice to heaven, saying, "Father Jove, is there none of the gods who will take pity upon me and save me from the river? I do not care what may happen to me afterwards. I blame none of the other dwellers on Olympus so severely as I do my dear mother, who has beguiled and tricked me. She told me I was to fall under the walls of Troy by the flying arrows of Apollo. Would that Hector, the best man among the Trojans, might there slay me. Then should I fall a hero by the hand of a hero. Whereas now it seems that I shall come to a most pitiable end, trapped in this river as though I were some swineherd's boy who gets carried down a torrent while trying to cross it during a storm." As soon as he had spoken thus, Neptune and Minerva came up to him in the likeness of two men and took him by the hand to reassure him. Neptune spoke first. "Son of Peleus," said he, "be not so exceeding fearful. We are two gods, come with Jove's sanction to assist you, I and Pallas Minerva. It is not your fate to perish in this river. He will abate presently, as you will see. Moreover, we strongly advise you, if you will be guided by us, not to stay your hand from fighting till you have pent the Trojan host within the famed walls of Ilius, as many of them as may escape. Then kill Hector and go back to the ships, for we will vouchsafe you a triumph over him." When they had so said, they went back to the other immortals, but Achilles strove onward over the plain, encouraged by the charge the gods had laid upon him. All was now covered with a flood of waters, and much goodly armour of the youth that had been slain was rifting about, as also many corpses. But he forced his way against the stream, speeding right onwards, nor could the broad waters stay him, for Minerva had endowed him with great strength. Nevertheless, Scamander did not slacken in his pursuit, but was still more furious with the son of Peleus. He lifted his waters into a high crest and cried aloud to Simois, saying, "Dear brother, let the two of us unite to save this man, or he will sack the mighty city of King Priam, and the Trojans will not hold out against him. Help me at once. Fill your streams with water from their sources. Rouse all your torrents to a fury. Raise your waves on high, and let snags and stones come thundering down, that we may make an end of this savage creature, who is now lording it as though it were a god. Nothing shall serve him longer, not strength, nor comeliness, nor his fine armour, which forsooth shall soon be lying low in the deep waters, covered over with mud. I will wrap him in sand, and pour tons of shingle round him, so that the Achaean shall not know how to gather his bones for the silt in which I shall have hidden him, and when they celebrate his funeral, they need build no barrow." On this he upraised his tumultuous flood high against Achilles, seething as it was with foam and blood and the bodies of the dead. The dark waters of the river stood upright and would have overwhelmed the son of Peleus, but Juno, trembling lest Achilles should be swept away in the mighty torrent, lifted her voice on high and called out to Vulcan her son. "Crookfoot," she cried, "my child, be up and doing, for I deem it is with you that Xanthus is fain to fight. Help us at once, kindle a fierce fire. I will then bring up the west and the white south wind in a mighty hurricane from the sea, that shall bear the flames against the heads and armour of the Trojans and consume them, while you go along the banks of Xanthus, burning his trees and wrapping him round with fire. Let him not turn you back neither by fair words nor foul, and slacken not till I shout and tell you. Then you may stay your flames." On this Vulcan kindled a fierce fire, which broke out first upon the plain and burned the many dead whom Achilles had killed and whose bodies were lying about in great numbers. By this means the plain was dried and the flood stayed. As the north wind, blowing on an orchard that has been sodden with autumn rain, soon dries it and the heart of the owner is glad, even so the whole plain was dried and the dead bodies were consumed. Then he turned tongues of fire onto the river. He burned the elms, the willows and the tamarisks, the lotus also, with the rushes and marshy herbage that grew abundantly by the banks of the river. The eels and fishes that go darting about everywhere in the water, These two were sorely harassed by the flames that cunning Vulcan had kindled, and the river himself was scalded, so that he spoke, saying, "Vulcan, there is no god can hold his own against you. I cannot fight you when you flare out your flames in this way. Strive with me no longer. Let Achilles drive the Trojans out of their city immediately. What have I to do with quarrelling and helping people?" He was boiling as he spoke, and all his waters were seething, as a cauldron upon a large fire boils when it is melting the lard of some fatted hog, and the lard keeps bubbling up all over when the dry faggots blaze under it. Even so were the goodly waters of Xanthus heated with the fire till they were boiling. He could flow no longer, but stayed his stream, so afflicted was he by the blasts of fire which cunning Vulcan had raised. Then he prayed to Juno, and besought her, saying, "Juno, why should your son vex my stream with such a special fury? I am not so much to blame as all the others are who have been helping the Trojans. I will leave off, since you so desire it, and let your son leave off also. Furthermore, I swear never again will I do anything to save the Trojans from destruction, not even when all Troy is burning in the flames which the Achaeans will kindle." As soon as Juno heard this, she said to her son Vulcan, "Son Vulcan, now hold your flames. We ought not to use such violence against a god for the sake of mortals." When she had thus spoken, Vulcan quenched his flames, and the river went back once more into his own fair bed. Xanthus was now beaten, so these two left off fighting, for Juno stayed them, though she was still angry. But a furious quarrel broke out among the other gods, for they were of divided counsels. They fell on one another with a mighty uproar. Earth groaned, and the spacious firmament rang out as with a blare of trumpets. Jove heard as he was sitting on Olympus, and laughed for joy when he saw the gods coming to blows among themselves. They were not long about beginning, and Mars, piercer of shields, opened the battle. Sword in hand, he sprang at once upon Minerva, and reviled her. "Why, vixen," said he, "have you again set the gods by the ears and the pride and haughtiness of your heart? Have you forgotten how you set Diomed, son of Tydeus, on to wound me, and yourself took visible spear and drove it into me to the hurt of my fair body? You shall now suffer for what you then did to me." As he spoke, he struck her on the terrible tasselled aegis, so terrible that not even can Jove's lightning pierce it. Here did murderous Mars strike her with his great spear. She drew back, and with her strong hand seized a stone that was lying on the plain, great and rugged and black, which men of old had set for the boundary of a field. With this she struck Mars on the neck and brought him down. 9 roods did he cover in his fall, and his hair was all soiled in the dust, while his armour rang rattling round him. But Minerva laughed and vaunted over him, saying, "Idiot, have you not learned how far stronger I am than you, but you must still match yourself against me? Thus do your mother's curses now roost upon you, for she is angry and would do you mischief, because you have deserted the Achaeans and are helping the Trojans." She then turned her 2 piercing eyes elsewhere, whereon Jove's daughter Venus took Mars by the hand and led him away groaning all the time, for it was only with great difficulty that he had come to himself again. When Queen Juno saw her, she said to Minerva, "Look, daughter of aegis-bearing Jove, unweariable, that vixen Venus is again taking Mars through the crowd out of the battle. Go after her at once." Thus she spoke. Minerva sped after Venus with a will, and made at her, striking her on the bosom with her strong hand, so that she fell fainting to the ground, and there they both lay, stretched at full length. Then Minerva vaunted over her, saying, "May all who help the Trojans against the Argives prove just as redoubtable and stalwart as Venus did when she came across me while she was helping Mars. Had this been so, we should long since have ended the war by sacking the strong city of Ilius." Juno smiled as she listened. Meanwhile, King Neptune turned to Apollo, saying, "Phoebus, why should we keep each other at arm's length? It is not well now that the others have begun fighting. It will be disgraceful to us if we return to Jove's bronze-floored mansion on Olympus without having fought each other. Therefore, come on. You are the younger of the two, and I ought not to attack you, for I am older and have had more experience. Idiot, you have no sense, and forget how we two alone of all the gods fared hardly round about Ilius when we came from Jove's house and worked for Laomedon a whole year at a stated wage, and he gave us his orders. I built the Trojans the wall about their city, so wide and fair that it might be impregnable, while you, Phoebus, herded cattle for him in the dales of many-valleyed Ida. When, however, the glad hours brought round the time of payment, mighty Laomedon robbed us of all our hire, and sent us off with nothing but abuse. He threatened to bind us hand and foot, and sell us over into some distant land. He tried, moreover, to cut off the ears of both of us, so we went away in a rage, furious about the payment he had promised us, and yet withheld. In spite of all this, you are now showing favour to his people, and will not join us in compassing the utter ruin of the proud Trojans with their wives and children. And King Apollo answered, Lord of the Earthquake, you would have no respect for me if I were to fight you about a pack of miserable mortals who come out like leaves in summer and eat the fruit of the field and presently fall lifeless to the ground. Let us stay this fighting at once and let them settle it among themselves. He turned away as he spoke, for he would lay no hand on the brother of his own father. But his sister, the huntress Diana, patroness of wild beasts, was very angry with him, and said, So you would fly, far darter, and hand victory over to Neptune, with a cheap vaunt to boot. Baby, why keep your bow thus idle? Never let me again hear you bragging in my father's house, as you have often done in the presence of the immortals, that you would stand up and fight with Neptune. Apollo made her no answer, but Jove's august queen was angry and upbraided her bitterly. Bold vixen, she cried, how dare you cross me thus? For all your bow, you will find it hard to hold your own against me. Jove made you as a lion among women, and lets you kill them whenever you choose. You will find it better to chase wild beasts and deer upon the mountains than to fight those who are stronger than you are. If you would try war, do so, and find out by pitting yourself against me how far stronger I am than you are. She caught both Diana's wrists with her left hand as she spoke, and with her right she took the bow from her shoulders, and laughed as she beat her with it about the ears, while Diana wriggled and writhed under her blows. Her swift arrows were shed upon the ground, and she fled weeping from under Juno's hand, as a dove that flies before a falcon to the cleft of some hollow rock, when it is her good fortune to escape. Even so did she fly weeping away, leaving her bow and arrows behind her. Then the slayer of Argus, guide and guardian, said to Leto, Leto, I shall not fight you. It is ill to come to blows with any of Jove's wives. Therefore, boast as you will among the immortals that you worsted me in fair fight. Leto then gathered up Diana's bow and arrows that had fallen about amid the whirling dust, and when she had got them, she made all haste after her daughter. Diana had now reached Jove's bronze-floored mansion on Olympus, and sat herself down with many tears on the knees of her father, while her ambrosial raiment was quivering all about her. The son of Saturn drew her towards him, and laughing pleasantly the while began to question her, saying, Which of the heavenly beings, my dear child, has been treating you in this cruel manner, as though you had been misconducting yourself in the face of everybody? And the fair-crowned goddess of the chase answered, It was your wife, Juno, father, who has been beating me. It is always her doing whenever there is any quarrelling among the immortals. Thus did they converse, and meanwhile Phoebus Apollo entered the strong city of Ilius, for he was uneasy lest the wall should not hold out, and the Danaans should take the city then and there, before its hour had come. But the rest of the ever-living gods went back, some angry and some triumphant, to Olympus, where they took their seats beside Jove, lord of the storm-cloud, while Achilles still kept on dealing out death alike on the Trojans and on their horses. As when the smoke from some burning city ascends to heaven when the anger of the gods has kindled it, there is then toil for all and sorrow for not a few. Even so did Achilles bring toil and sorrow on the Trojans. Old King Priam stood on a high tower of the wall looking down on huge Achilles as the Trojans fled panic-stricken before him, and there was none to help them. Presently he came down from off the tower, and with many a groan went along the wall to give orders to the brave warders of the gate. "Keep the gate," said he, "wide open till the people come flying into the city, for Achilles is hard by and is driving them in rout before him. I see we are in great peril. As soon as our people are inside and in safety, close the strong gates, for I fear lest that terrible man should come bounding inside along with the others." As he spoke, they drew back the bolts and opened the gates, and when these were opened, there was a haven of refuge for the Trojans. Apollo then came full speed out of the city to meet them and protect them. Right for the city and the high wall, parched with thirst and grimy with dust, still they fled on, with Achilles wielding his spear furiously behind them, for he was as one possessed and was thirsting after glory. Then had the sons of the Achaeans taken the lofty gates of Troy, if Apollo had not spurred on Agenor, valiant and noble son of Antenor. He put courage into his heart, and stood by his side to guard him, leaning against a beech tree, and shrouded in thick darkness. When Agenor saw Achilles, he stood still, and his heart was clouded with care. "Alas," said he to himself in his dismay, "if I fly before mighty Achilles, and go where all the others are being driven in rout, he will nonetheless catch me and kill me for a coward. How would it be if I were to let Achilles drive the others before him, and then fly from the wall to the plain that is behind Ilius, till I reach the spurs of Ida, and can hide in the underwood that is thereon? I could then wash the sweat from off me in the river, and in the evening return to Ilius. But why commune with myself in this way? Like enough he would see me as I am hurrying from the city over the plain, and would speed after me till he had caught me. I should stand no chance against him, for he is mightiest of all mankind. What then if I go out and meet him in front of the city? His flesh, too, I take it, can be pierced by pointed bronze. Life is the same in one and all, and men say that he is but mortal, despite the triumph that Jove, son of Saturn, vouchsafes him." So saying, he stood on his guard and awaited Achilles, for he was now fain to fight him. As a leopardess that bounds from out of a thick covert to attack a hunter, she knows no fear and is not dismayed by the baying of the hounds, even though the man be too quick for her and wound her either with thrust or spear. Still, though the spear has pierced her, she will not give in till she has either caught him in her grip or been killed outright. Even so did noble Agenor, son of Antenor, refuse to fly till he had made trial of Achilles, and took aim at him with his spear, holding his round shield before him, and crying with a loud voice, "Of a truth," said he, "noble Achilles, you deem that you shall this day sack the city of the proud Trojans. Fool, there will be trouble enough yet before it, for there is many a brave man of us still inside who will stand in front of our dear parents, with our wives and children, to defend Ilius. Here, therefore, huge and mighty warrior though you be, here shall you die." As he spoke, his strong hand hurled his javelin from him, and the spear struck Achilles on the leg beneath the knee. The greave of newly wrought tin rang loudly, but the spear recoiled from the body of him whom it had struck, and did not pierce it, for the god's gift stayed it. Achilles, in his turn, attacked noble Agenor, but Apollo would not vouchsafe him glory, for he snatched Agenor away and hid him in a thick mist, sending him out of the battle unmolested. Then he craftily drew the son of Peleus away from going after the host, for he put on the semblance of Agenor and stood in front of Achilles, who ran towards him to give chase and pursued him over the cornlands of the plain, turning him towards the deep waters of the river Scamander. Apollo ran but a little way before him, and beguiled Achilles by making him think all the time that he was on the point of overtaking him. Meanwhile, the rabble of routed Trojans was thankful to crowd within the city till their numbers thronged it. No longer did they dare wait for one another outside the city walls to learn who had escaped and who were fallen in fight, but all whose feet and knees could still carry them poured pell-mell into the town. End of section 21.
Section 22 of the Iliad by Homer, translated by Samuel Butler. Book 22. The Death of Hector. Thus the Trojans in the city, scared like fawns, wiped the sweat from off them, and drank to quench their thirst, leaning against the goodly battlements, while the Achaeans, with their shields laid upon their shoulders, drew close up to the walls. But stern fate bade Hector stay where he was before Ilius and the Scaean gates. Then Phoebus Apollo spoke to the son of Peleus, saying, "Why, son of Peleus, do you, who are but a man, give chase to me who am immortal? Have you not yet found out that it is a god whom you pursue so furiously? You did not harass the Trojans whom you had routed, and now they are within their walls, while you have been decoyed hither, away from them. Me you cannot kill, for death can take no hold upon me." Achilles was greatly angered, and said, "You have balked me, far Darter, most malicious of all gods, and have drawn me away from the wall, where many another man would have bitten the dust ere he got within Ilius. You have robbed me of great glory, and have saved the Trojans, at no risk to yourself, for you have nothing to fear. But I would indeed have my revenge if it were in my power to do so." On this, with fell intent, he made towards the city, and as the winning horse in a chariot race strains every nerve when he is flying over the plain, even so fast and furiously did the limbs of Achilles bear him onwards. King Priam was first to note him as he scoured the plain, all radiant as the star which men called Orion's hound, and whose beams blaze forth in time of harvest more brilliantly than those of any other that shines by night. Brightest of them, although he be, yet he bodes ill for mortals, for he brings fire and fever in his train. Even so did Achilles' armour gleam on his breast as he sped onwards. Priam raised a cry and beat his head with his hands as he lifted them up and shouted out to his dear son, imploring him to return. But Hector still stayed before the gates, for his heart was set upon doing battle with Achilles. The old man reached out his arms towards him and bade him for pity's sake come within the walls. "Hector," he cried, "my son, stay not to face this man alone and unsupported, or you will meet death at the hands of the son of Peleus, for he is mightier than you. Monster that he is, would indeed that the gods loved him no better than I do, for so dogs and vultures would soon devour him as he lay stretched on earth, and a load of grief would be lifted from my heart, for many a brave son has he reft from me, either by killing them or selling them away in the islands that are beyond the sea. Even now I miss two sons from among the Trojans who have thronged within the city, Lycaon and Polydorus, whom Laothoe, peeress among women, bore me. Should they be still alive and in the hands of the Achaeans, we will ransom them with gold and bronze, of which we have store, for the old man Altes endowed his daughter richly. But if they are already dead and in the house of Hades, sorrow will it be to us two who were their parents, albeit the grief of others will be more short-lived, unless you too perish at the hands of Achilles. Come then, my son, within the city, to be the guardian of Trojan men and Trojan women, or you will both lose your own life and afford a mighty triumph to the son of Peleus. Have pity also on your unhappy father while life yet remains to him, on me, whom the son of Saturn will destroy by a terrible doom on the threshold of old age, after I have seen my sons slain and my daughters haled away as captives, my bridal chambers pillaged, my little children dashed to earth amid the rage of battle, and my sons' wives dragged away by the cruel hands of the Achaeans. In the end, fierce hounds will tear me in pieces at my own gates after someone has beaten the life out of my body with sword or spear hounds that I myself reared and fed at my own table to guard my gates, but who would yet lap my blood and then lie all distraught at my doors? When a young man falls by the sword in battle, he may lie where he is, and there is nothing unseemly. Let what will be seen. All is honourable in death. But when an old man is slain, there is nothing in this world more pitiable than that the dog should defile his grey hair and beard and all that men hide for shame." The old man tore his grey hair as he spoke, but he moved not the heart of Hector. His mother hard by wept and moaned aloud as she bared her bosom and pointed to the breast which had suckled him. "Hector," she cried, weeping bitterly the while, "Hector, my son, spurn not this breast, but have pity upon me too. If I have ever given you comfort from my own bosom, think on it now, dear son, and come within the wall to protect us from this man. Stand not without to meet him. Should the wretch kill you, neither I nor your richly dowered wife shall ever weep, dear offshoot of myself, over the bed on which you lie, for dogs will devour you at the ships of the Achaeans." Thus did the two with many tears implore their son, but they moved not the heart of Hector, and he stood his ground, awaiting huge Achilles as he drew nearer towards him. As a serpent in its den upon the mountains, full fed with deadly poisons, waits for the approach of man, he is filled with fury, and his eyes glare terribly as he goes writhing round his den. Even so, Hector leant his shield against a tower that jutted out from the wall, and stood where he was, undaunted. Alas, he said to himself in the heaviness of his heart, if I go within the gates, Polydamas will be the first to heap reproach upon me, for it was he that urged me to lead the Trojans back to the city on that awful night when Achilles again came forth against us. I would not listen, but it would have been indeed better if I had done so. Now that my folly has destroyed the host, I dare not look Trojan men and Trojan women in the face, lest a worse man should say, Hector has ruined us by his self-confidence. Surely it would be better for me to return after having fought Achilles and slain him, or to die gloriously here before the city. What again if I were to lay down my shield and helmet, lean my spear against the wall, and go straight up to noble Achilles? What if I were to promise to give up Helen, who was the fountainhead of all this war, and all the treasure that Alexandrus brought with him in his ships to Troy? Ay, and to let the Achaeans divide the half of everything that the city contains among themselves. I might make the Trojans, by the mouths of their princes, take a solemn oath that they would hide nothing, but would divide into two shares all that is within the city. But why argue with myself in this way? Were I to go up to him, he would show me no kind of mercy. He would kill me then and there, as easily as though I were a woman, when I had off my armour. There is no parleying with him from some rock or oak tree, as young men and maidens prattle with one another. Better fight him at once, and learn to which of us Jove will vouchsafe victory. Thus did he stand and ponder, but Achilles came up to him, as it were Mars himself, plumed lord of battle. From his right shoulder he brandished his terrible spear of Pelian ash, and the bronze gleamed around him like flashing fire or the rays of the rising sun. Fear fell upon Hector as he beheld him, and he dared not stay longer where he was, but fled in dismay from before the gates, while Achilles darted after him at his utmost speed. As a mountain falcon, swiftest of all birds, swoops down upon some cowering dove, the dove flies before him, but the falcon, with a shrill scream, follows close after, resolved to have her. Even so did Achilles make straight for Hector with all his might, while Hector fled under the Trojan wall as fast as his limbs could take him. On they flew along the wagon road that ran hard by under the wall, past the lookout station, and past the weather-beaten wild fig tree, till they came to two fair springs which feed the river Scamander. One of these two springs is warm, and steam rises from it as smoke from a burning fire, but the other, even in summer, is as cold as hail or snow, or the ice that forms on water. Here, hard by the springs, are the goodly washing troughs of stone, where, in the time of peace, before the coming of the Achaeans, the wives and fair daughters of the Trojans used to wash their clothes. Past these did they fly, the one in front and the other giving chase behind him. Good was the man that fled, but better far was he that followed after, and swiftly indeed did they run, for the prize was no mere beast for sacrifice, or bullock's hide, as it might be, for a common foot-race, but they ran for the life of Hector. As horses in a chariot-race speed round the turning-post, when they are running for some great prize, a tripod or woman, at the games in honour of some dead hero, so did these two run full speed 3 times round the city of Priam. All the gods watched them, and the sire of gods and men was the first to speak. Alas, said he, my eyes behold a man who is dear to me, being pursued round the walls of Troy. My heart is full of pity for Hector, who has burned the thigh bones of many a heifer in my honour, one while on the crests of many valleyed Ida, and again on the citadel of Troy. And now I see noble Achilles in full pursuit of him round the city of Priam. What say you? Consider among yourselves and decide whether we shall now save him or let him fall, valiant though he be, before Achilles, son of Peleus. Then Minerva said, Father, wielder of the lightning, lord of cloud and storm, what mean you? Would you pluck this mortal, whose doom has long been decreed, out of the jaws of death? Do as you will, but we others shall not be of a mind with you. And Jove answered, My child, Trito-born, take heart. I did not speak in full earnest, and I will let you have your way. Do without let or hindrance, as you are minded. Thus did he urge Minerva, who was already eager, and down she darted from the topmost summits of Olympus. Achilles was still in full pursuit of Hector, as a hound chasing a fawn which he has started from its covert on the mountains, and hunts through glade and thicket. The fawn may try to elude him by crouching under cover of a bush, but he will send her out and follow her up until he gets her. Even so, there was no escape for Hector from the fleet son of Peleus. Whenever he made a set to get near the Dardanian gates and under the walls, that his people might help him by showering down weapons from above, Achilles would gain on him and head him back towards the plain, keeping himself always on the city side. As a man in a dream who fails to lay hands upon another whom he is pursuing, the one cannot escape, nor the other overtake. Even so, neither could Achilles come up with Hector, nor Hector break away from Achilles. Nevertheless, he might even yet have escaped death, had not the time come when Apollo, who thus far had sustained his strength and nerved his running, was now no longer to stay by him. Achilles made signs to the Achaean host, and shook his head to show that no man was to aim a dart at Hector, lest another might win the glory of having hit him, and he himself come in second. Then, at last, as they were nearing the fountains for the fourth time, the father of all balanced his golden scales and placed a doom in each of them, one for Achilles and the other for Hector. As he held the scales by the middle, the doom of Hector fell down deep into the house of Hades, and then Phoebus Apollo left him. Therein Minerva went close up to the son of Peleus and said, "Noble Achilles, favoured of heaven, we too shall surely take back to the ships a triumph for the Achaeans by slaying Hector for all his lust of battle. Do what Apollo may as he lies grovelling before his father, aegis-bearing Jove. Hector cannot escape us longer. Stay here and take breath, while I go up to him and persuade him to make a stand and fight you." Thus spoke Minerva. Achilles obeyed her gladly and stood still, leaning on his bronze-pointed ashen spear, while Minerva left him and went after Hector in the form and with the voice of Deiphobus. She came close up to him and said, "Dear brother, I see you are hard-pressed by Achilles, who is chasing you at full speed round the city of Priam. Let us await his onset and stand on our defence." And Hector answered, "Deiphobus, you have always been dearest to me of all my brothers, children of Hecuba and Priam, but henceforth I shall rate you yet more highly, inasmuch as you have ventured outside the wall for my sake, when all the others remain inside." Then Minerva said, "Dear brother, my father and mother went down on their knees and implored me, as did all my comrades, to remain inside, so great a fear has fallen upon them all. But I was in an agony of grief when I beheld you. Now, therefore, let us too make a stand and fight, and let there be no keeping our spears in reserve, that we may learn whether Achilles shall kill us and bear off our spoils to the ships, or whether he shall fall before you." Thus did Minerva inveigle him by her cunning, and when the two were now close to one another, great Hector was first to speak. "I will no longer fly you, son of Peleus," said he, "as I have been doing hitherto. 3 times have I fled round the mighty city of Priam, without daring to withstand you. But now let me either slay or be slain, for I am in the mind to face you. Let us then give pledges to one another by our gods, who are the fittest witnesses and guardians of all covenants. Let it be agreed between us that if Jove vouchsafes me the longest stay and I take your life, I am not to treat your dead body in any unseemly fashion. But when I have stripped you of your armour, I am to give up your body to the Achaeans, and do you likewise." Achilles glared at him and answered, "Fool, prate not to me about covenants. There can be no covenants between men and lions. Wolves and lambs can never be of one mind, but hate each other out and out all through. Therefore there can be no understanding between you and me, nor may there be any covenants between us, till one or other shall fall and glut grim Mars with his life's blood. Put forth all your strength. You have need now to prove yourself indeed a bold soldier and man of war. You have no more chance, and Pallas Minerva will forthwith vanquish you by my spear. You shall now pay me in full for the grief you have caused me on account of my comrades whom you have killed in battle." He poised his spear as he spoke and hurled it. Hector saw it coming and avoided it. He watched it and crouched down so that it flew over his head and stuck in the ground beyond. Minerva then snatched it up and gave it back to Achilles without Hector's seeing her. Hector thereon said to the son of Peleus, "You've missed your aim, Achilles, spear of the gods, and Jove has not yet revealed to you the hour of my doom, though you made sure that he had done so. You were a false-tongued liar when you deemed that I should forget my valour and quail before you. You shall not drive your spear into the back of a runaway. Drive it, should heaven so grant you power, drive it into me as I make straight towards you. And now, for your own part, avoid my spear if you can, would that you might receive the whole of it into your body. If you are once dead, the Trojans would find the war an easier matter, for it is you who have harmed them most." He poised his spear as he spoke, and hurled it. His aim was true, for he hit the middle of Achilles' shield, but the spear rebounded from it, and did not pierce it. Hector was angry when he saw that the weapon had sped from his hand in vain, and stood there in dismay, for he had no second spear. With a loud cry he called Deiphobus, and asked him for one, but there was no man. Then he saw the truth, and said to himself, "Alas, the gods have lured me on to my destruction. I deemed that the hero Deiphobus was by my side, but he is within the wall, and Minerva has inveigled me. Death is now indeed exceedingly near at hand, and there is no way out of it, for so Jove and his son Apollo, the far darter, have willed it, though heretofore they have been ever ready to protect me. My doom has come upon me. Let me not then die ingloriously and without a struggle, but let me first do some great thing that should be told among men hereafter." And as he spoke, he drew the keen blade that hung so great and strong by his side, and gathering himself together, he sprang on Achilles like a soaring eagle which swoops down from the clouds onto some lamb or timid hare. Even so did Hector brandish his sword and spring upon Achilles. Achilles, mad with rage, darted towards him with his wondrous shield before his breast and his gleaming helmet made with four layers of metal, nodding fiercely forward. The thick tresses of gold within which Vulcan had crested the helmet floated round it, and as the evening star that shines brighter than all the others through the stillness of night, even such was the gleam of the spear which Achilles poised in his right hand, fraught with the death of noble Hector. He eyed his fair flesh over and over to see where he could best wound it, but all was protected by the goodly armour of which Hector had spoiled Patroclus after he had slain him, save only the throat, where the collarbone divides the neck from the shoulders, and this is the most deadly place. Here then did Achilles strike him as he was coming on towards him, and the point of his spear went right through the fleshy part of the neck, but it did not sever his windpipe, so that he could still speak. Hector fell headlong, and Achilles vaunted over him, saying, "Hector, you deemed that you should come off scatheless when you were spoiling Patroclus, and recked not of myself, who was not with him. Fool that you were, for I, his comrade, mightier far than he, was still left behind him at the ships, and now I have laid you low. The Achaeans shall give him all due funeral rites, while dogs and vultures shall work their will upon yourself." Then Hector said, as the life ebbed out of him, "I pray you, by your life and knees, and by your parents, let not dogs devour me at the ships of the Achaeans, but accept the rich treasure of gold and bronze which my father and mother will offer you, and send my body home, that the Trojans and their wives may give me my dues of fire when I am dead." Achilles glared at him and answered, "Dog! Talk not to me neither of knees nor parents. Would that I could be as sure of being able to cut your flesh into pieces and eat it raw for the ill you have done me, as I am that nothing shall save you from the dogs. It shall not be, though they bring 10 or 20-fold ransom and weigh it out for me on the spot with promise of yet more hereafter. Though Priam, son of Dardanus, should bid them offer me your weight in gold, even so your mother shall never lay you out and make lament over the son she bore, but dogs and vultures shall eat you utterly up." Hector, with his dying breath, then said, "I know what you are, and it were sure that I should not move you, for your heart is hard as iron. Look to it that I bring not heaven's anger upon you on the day when Paris and Phoebus Apollo, valiant though you be, shall slay you at the Scaean gates." When he had thus said, the shrouds of death enfolded him, whereon his soul went out of him, and flew down to the house of Hades, lamenting its sad fate that it should enjoy youth and strength no longer. But Achilles said, speaking to the dead body, "Die! For my part I will accept my fate whensoever Jove and the other gods see fit to send it." As he spoke, he drew his spear from the body and set it on one side. Then he stripped the blood-stained armour from Hector's shoulders, while the other Achaeans came running up to view his wondrous strength and beauty, and no one came near him without giving him a fresh wound. Then would one turn to his neighbour and say, "It is easier to handle Hector now than when he was flinging fire onto our ships," and as he spoke he would thrust his spear into him anew. When Achilles had done spoiling Hector of his armour, he stood among the Argives and said, "My friends, princes and counsellors of the Argives, now that heaven has vouchsafed us to overcome this man, who has done us more hurt than all the others together, consider whether we should not attack the city in force, and discover in what mind the Trojans may be. We should thus learn whether they will desert their city now that Hector has fallen, or will still hold out even though he is no longer living. But why argue with myself in this way, while Patroclus is still lying at the ships unburied and unmourned? He whom I can never forget so long as I am alive and my strength fails not. Though men forget the dead when once they are within the house of Hades, yet not even there will I forget the comrade whom I have lost. Now therefore, Achaean youths, let us raise the song of victory, and go back to the ships, taking this man along with us, for we have achieved a mighty triumph, and have slain noble Hector, to whom the Trojans prayed throughout their city as though he were a god." On this he treated the body of Hector with contumely. He pierced the sinews at the back of both his feet from head to ankle, and passed thongs of oxhide through the slits he had made. Thus he made the body fast to his chariot, letting the head trail upon the ground. Then, when he had put the goodly armour on the chariot and had himself mounted, he lashed his horses on, and they flew forward, nothing loath. The dust rose from Hector as he was being dragged along. His dark hair flew all abroad, and his head, once so comely, was laid low on earth, for Jove had now delivered him into the hands of his foe to do him outrage in his own land. Thus was the head of Hector being dishonoured in the dust. His mother tore her hair and flung her veil from her with a loud cry as she looked upon her son. His father made piteous moan, and throughout the city the people fell to weeping and wailing. It was as though the whole of frowning Ilius was being besmirched with fire. Hardly could the people hold Priam back in his hot haste to rush without the gates of the city. He grovelled in the mire and besought them, calling each of them by his name. "Let be, my friends," he cried, "and with all your sorrow suffer me to go single-handed to the ships of the Achaeans. Let me beseech this cruel and terrible man, if maybe he will respect the feeling of his fellow men and have compassion on my old age. His own father is even such another as myself, Peleus, who bred him and reared him to be the bane of us Trojans, and of myself more than of all others. Many a son of mine has he slain in the flower of his youth, and yet, grieve for these as I may, I do so for one, Hector, more than for them all, and the bitterness of my sorrow will bring me down to the house of Hades. Would that he had died in my arms, for so both his ill-starred mother who bore him and myself should have had the comfort of weeping and mourning over him." Thus did he speak with many tears, and all the people of the city joined in his lament. Hecuba then raised the cry of wailing among the Trojans. "Alas, my son," she cried, "what have I left to live for now that you are no more? Night and day did I glory on you throughout the city, for you were a tower of strength to all in Troy, and both men and women alike hailed you as a god. So long as you lived, you were their pride, and now death and destruction have fallen upon you." Hector's wife had as yet heard nothing, for no one had come to tell her that her husband had remained without the gates. She was at her loom in an inner part of the house, weaving a double purple web and embroidering it with many flowers. She told her maids to set a large tripod on the fire so as to have a warm bath ready for Hector when he came out of battle.
Poor woman, she knew not that he was now beyond the reach of baths, and that Minerva had laid him low by the hands of Achilles. She heard the cry coming as from the wall, and trembled in every limb. The shuttle fell from her hands, and again she spoke to her waiting women. "Two of you," she said, "come with me that I may learn what it is that has befallen. I heard the voice of my husband's honoured mother. My own heart beats as though it would come into my mouth, and my limbs refuse to carry me. Some great misfortune for Priam's children must be at hand. May I never live to hear it, but I greatly fear that Achilles has cut off the retreat of brave Hector and has chased him onto the plain where he was single-handed. I fear he may have put an end to the reckless daring which possessed my husband, who would never remain within the body of his men, but would dash on far in front, foremost of them all in valour." Her heart beat fast, and as she spoke she flew from the house like a maniac, with her wailing women following after. When she reached the battlements and the crowd of people, she stood looking out upon the wall, and saw Hector being borne away in front of the city, the horses dragging him without heed or care over the ground towards the ships of the Achaeans. Her eyes were then shrouded as with the darkness of night, and she fell fainting backwards. She tore the attiring from her head and flung it from her, the frontlet and net with its plaited band, and the veil which golden Venus had given her on the day when Hector took her with him from the house of Eetion, after having given countless gifts of wooing for her sake. Her husband's sisters and the wives of his brothers crowded round her and supported her, for she was fain to die in her distraction. When she again presently breathed and came to herself, she sobbed and made lament among the Trojans, saying, "Woe is me, O Hector, woe indeed, that to share a common lot we were born, you at Troy in the house of Priam, and I at Thebes under the wooded mountain of Placus in the house of Eetion, who brought me up when I was a child. Ill-starred sire of an ill-starred daughter, would that he had never begotten me. You are now going into the house of Hades, under the secret places of the earth, and you leave me, a sorrowing widow, in your house. The child of whom you and I are the unhappy parents is as yet a mere infant. Now that you are gone, O Hector, you can do nothing for him, nor he for you. Even though he escaped the horrors of this woeful war with the Achaeans, yet shall his life henceforth be one of labour and sorrow, for others will seize his lands. The day that robs a child of his parents severs him from his own kind. His head is bowed, his cheeks are wet with tears, and he will go about destitute among the friends of his father, plucking one by the cloak and another by the shirt. Some one or other of these may so far pity him as to hold the cup for a moment towards him and let him moisten his lips, but he must not drink enough to wet the roof of his mouth. Then one whose parents are alive will drive him from the table with blows and angry words. 'Out with you,' he will say, 'you have no father here.' And the child will go crying back to his widowed mother. He, Astyanax, who erstwhile would sit upon his father's knees and have none but the daintiest and choicest morsels set before him. When he had played till he was tired and went to sleep, he would lie in a bed in the arms of his nurse on a soft couch, knowing neither want nor care. Whereas now that he has lost his father, his lot will be full of hardship. He whom the Trojans name Astyanax, because you, O Hector, were the only defence of their gates and battlements. The wriggling, writhing worms will now eat you at the ships, far from your parents, when the dogs have glutted themselves upon you. You will lie naked, though in your house you have fine and goodly raiment made by hands of women. This will I now burn. It is of no use to you, for you can never again wear it. And thus will you have respect shown you by the Trojans, both men and women." In such wise did she cry aloud amid her tears, and the women joined in her lament. End of section 22. Section 23 of The Iliad by Homer, translated by Samuel Butler. Book 23. The funeral of Patroclus and the funeral games. Thus did they make their moan throughout the city, while the Achaeans, when they reached the Hellespont, went back every man to his own ship. But Achilles would not let the Myrmidons go, and spoke to his brave comrade, saying, "Myrmidons, famed horsemen, and my own trusted friends, not yet, forsooth, let us unyoke,
but with horse and chariot draw near to the body and mourn Patroclus in due honour to the dead. When we have had full comfort of lamentation, we will unyoke our horses and take supper, all of us here." On this they all joined in a cry of wailing, and Achilles led them in their lament. Thrice did they drive their chariots, all sorrowing, round the body, and Thetis stirred within them a still deeper yearning. The sands of the seashore and the men's armour were wet with their weeping, so great a minister of fear was he whom they had lost. Chief in all their mourning was the son of Peleus. He laid his blood-stained hand on the breast of his friend. "Farewell," he cried, "Patroclus, even in the house of Hades. I will now do all that I erewhile promised you. I will drag Hector hither and let dogs devour him raw. 12 noble sons of Trojans will I also slay before your pyre to avenge you." As he spoke, he turned the body of noble Hector with contumely, laying it at full length in the dust beside the bier of Patroclus. The others then put off every man his armour, took the horses from their chariots, and seated themselves in great multitude by the ships of the fleet, descendant of Aeacus, who thereon feasted them with an abundant funeral banquet. Many a goodly ox, with many a sheep and bleating goat, did they butcher and cut up. Many a tusked boar, moreover, fat and well-fed, did they singe and set to roast in the flames of Vulcan, and rivulets of blood flowed all round the place where the body was lying. Then the princes of the Achaeans took the son of Peleus to Agamemnon, but hardly could they persuade him to come with them, so wroth was he for the death of his comrade. As soon as they reached Agamemnon's tent, they told the serving men to set a large tripod over the fire in case they might persuade the son of Peleus to wash the clotted gore from his body. But he denied them sternly, and swore it with a solemn oath, saying, "Nay, by King Jove, first and mightiest of all gods, it is not meet that water should touch my body till I have laid Patroclus on the flames, have built him a barrow, and shaved my head. For so long as I live, no such second sorrow shall ever draw nigh me. Now, therefore, let us do all that this sad festival demands. But at break of day, King Agamemnon, bid your men bring wood, and provide all else that the dead may duly take into the realm of darkness. The fire shall thus burn him out of our sight the sooner, and the people shall turn again to their own labours." Thus did he speak, and they did, even as he had said. They made haste to prepare the meal. They ate, and every man had his full share, so that all was satisfied. As soon as they had had enough to eat and drink, the others went to their rest, each in his own tent. But the son of Peleus lay grieving among his myrmidons by the shore of the sounding sea, in an open place where the waves came surging in one after another. Here a very deep slumber took hold upon him, and eased the burden of his sorrows, for his limbs were weary with chasing Hector round windy Ilius. Presently the sad spirit of Patroclus drew near him, like what he had been in stature, voice, and the light of his beaming eyes, clad too as he had been clad in life. The spirit hovered over his head, and said, "You sleep, Achilles, and have forgotten me. You loved me living, but now that I am dead, you think for me no further. Bury me with all speed, that I may pass the gates of Hades. The ghosts, vain shadows of men that can labour no more, drive me away from them. They will not yet suffer me to join those that are beyond the river, and I wander all desolate by the wide gates of the house of Hades. Give me now your hand, I pray you, for when you have once given me my dues of fire, never shall I again come forth out of the house of Hades. Nevermore shall we sit apart and take sweet counsel among the living. The cruel fate which was my birthright has yawned its wide jaws around me. Nay, you too, Achilles, peer of gods, are doomed to die beneath the wall of the noble Trojans. One prayer more will I make you, if you will grant it. Let not my bones be laid apart from yours, Achilles, but with them. Even as we were brought up together in your own home, that time Aeneas brought me to you as a child from Opoesus, because by a sad spite I had killed the son of Amphimedes, not of set purpose, but in childish quarrel over the dice. The knight Peleus took me into his house, entreated me kindly, and named me to be your squire. Therefore let our bones lie in but a single urn, the two-handled golden vase given to you by your mother. And Achilles answered, "Why, true heart, are you come hither to lay these charges upon me? I will of my own self do all as you have bidden me. Draw closer to me. Let us once more throw our arms around one another, and find sad comfort in the sharing of our sorrows." He opened his arms towards him as he spoke, and would have clasped him in them, but there was nothing, and the spirit vanished as a vapour, gibbering and whining into the earth. Achilles sprang to his feet, smote his two hands, and made lamentation, saying, "Of a truth, even in the house of Hades there are ghosts and phantoms that have no life in them. All night long the sad spirit of Patroclus has hovered overhead, making piteous moan, telling me what I am to do for him, and looking wondrously like himself." Thus did he speak, and his words set them all weeping and mourning about the poor dumb dead, till rosy-fingered Morn appeared. Then King Agamemnon sent man and mules from all parts of the camp to bring wood, and Meriones, squire to Idomeneus, was in charge over them. They went out with woodsmen's axes and strong ropes in their hands, and before them went the mules. Uphill and down dale did they go, by straight ways and crooked, and when they reached the heights of many a fount and Ida, they laid their axes to the roots of many a tall branching oak that came thundering down as they felled it. They split the trees and bound them behind the mules, which then wended their way as they best could through the thick brushwood onto the plain. All who had been cutting wood bore logs, for so Meriones, squire to Idomeneus, had bidden them, and they threw them down in a line upon the seashore at the place where Achilles would make a mighty monument for Patroclus and for himself. When they had thrown down their great logs of wood over the whole ground, they stayed all of them where they were, but Achilles ordered his brave Myrmidons to gird on their armour and to yoke each man his horses. They therefore rose, girded on their armour, and mounted each his chariot, they and their charioteers with them. The chariots went before, and they that were on foot followed as a cloud in their tens of thousands after. In the midst of them his comrades bore Patroclus, and covered him by the locks of their hair, which they cut off and threw upon his body. Last came Achilles with his head bowed for sorrow, so noble a comrade was he taking to the house of Hades. When they came to the place of which Achilles had told them, they laid the body down and built up the wood. Achilles then bethought him of another matter. He went a space away from the pyre, and cut off the yellow lock which he had let grow for the river Spercheius. He looked all sorrowfully out upon the dark sea, and said, "Spercheius, in vain did my father Peleus vow to you that when I returned home to my loved native land I should cut off this lock and offer you a holy hecatomb. 50 she-gates was I to sacrifice to you there at your springs, where is your grove and your altar fragrant with burnt offerings. Thus did my father vow, but you have not fulfilled his prayer. Now, therefore, that I shall see my home no more, I give this lock as a keepsake to the hero Patroclus." As he spoke, he placed the lock in the hands of his dear comrade, and all who were by were filled with yearning and lamentation. The sun would have gone down upon their mourning, had not Achilles presently said to Agamemnon, "Son of Atreus, for it is to you that the people will give ear. There is a time to mourn and a time to cease from mourning. Bid the people now leave the pyre and set about getting their dinners. We, to whom the dead is dearest, will see to what is wanted here, and let the other princes also stay by me." When King Agamemnon heard this, he dismissed the people to their ships, but those who were about the dead heaped up wood and built a pyre 100 feet this way and that. Then they laid the dead, all sorrowfully, upon the top of it. They flayed and dressed many fat sheep and oxen before the pyre, and Achilles took fat from all of them and wrapped the body therein from head to foot, heaping the flayed carcasses all round it. Against the bier he leaned 2-handled jars of honey and unguents. 4 proud horses did he then cast upon the pyre, groaning the while he did so. The dead hero had had house dogs. 2 of them did Achilles slay and threw upon the pyre. He also put 12 brave sons of noble Trojans to the sword and laid them with the rest, for he was full of bitterness and fury. Then he committed all to the resistless and devouring might of the fire. He groaned aloud and called on his dead comrade by name. "Farewell," he cried, "Patroclus, even in the house of Hades. I am now doing all that I have promised you.
12 brave sons of noble Trojans shall the flames consume along with yourself, but dogs, not fire, shall devour the flesh of Hector, son of Priam. Thus did he vaunt. But the dogs came not about the body of Hector, for Jove's daughter Venus kept them off him night and day, and anointed him with ambrosial oil of roses, that his flesh might not be torn when Achilles was dragging him about. Phoebus Apollo, moreover, sent a dark cloud from heaven to earth, which gave shade to the whole place where Hector lay, that the heat of the sun might not parch his body. Now the pyre about dead Patroclus would not kindle. Achilles, therefore, bethought him of another matter. He went apart and prayed to the two winds, Boreas and Zephyrus, vowing them goodly offerings. He made them many drink offerings from the golden cup, and besought them to come and help him, that the wood might make haste to kindle, and the dead bodies be consumed. Fleet Iris heard him praying, and started off to fetch the winds. They were holding high feast in the house of boisterous Zephyrus, when Iris came running up to the stone threshold of the house, and stood there. But as soon as they set eyes on her, they all came towards her, and each of them called her to him. But Iris would not sit down. "I cannot stay," she said. "I must go back to the streams of Oceanus and the land of the Ethiopians, who are offering hecatombs to the immortals, and I would have my share. But Achilles prays that Boreas and shrill Zephyrus will come to him, and he vows them goodly offerings. He would have you blow upon the pyre of Patroclus, for whom all the Achaeans are lamenting." With this she left them, and the two winds rose with a cry that rent the air and swept the clouds before them. They blew on until they came to the sea, and the waves rose high beneath them. But when they reached Troy, they fell upon the pyre till the mighty flames roared under the blast that they blew. All night long did they blow hard and beat upon the fire, and all night long did Achilles grasp his double cup, drawing wine from a mixing bowl of gold, and calling upon the spirit of dead Patroclus as he poured it upon the ground until the earth was drenched. As a father mourns when he is burning the bones of his bridegroom's son, whose death has wrung the hearts of his parents, even so did Achilles mourn, while burning the body of his comrade, pacing round the bier with piteous groaning and lamentation. At length, as the morning star was beginning to herald the light which saffron-mantled dawn was soon to suffuse over the sea, the flames fell, and the fire began to die. The winds then went home beyond the Thracian sea, which roared and boiled as they swept over it. The son of Peleus now turned away from the pyre and lay down, overcome with toil, till he fell into a sweet slumber. Presently they who were about the son of Atreus drew near in a body and roused him with the noise and tramp of their coming. He sat upright and said, "Son of Atreus and all other princes of the Achaeans, first pour red wine everywhere upon the fire and quench it. Let us then gather the bones of Patroclus, son of Menoetius, singling them out with care. They are easily found, for they lie in the middle of the pyre, while all else, both men and horses, has been thrown in a heap and burned at the other edge. We will lay the bones in a golden urn, in two layers of fat, against the time when I shall myself go down into the house of Hades. As for the barrow, labour not to raise a great one now, but such as is reasonable. Afterwards, let those Achaeans who may be left at the ships when I am gone build it both broad and high." Thus he spoke, and they obeyed the word of the son of Peleus. First they poured red wine upon the thick layer of ashes and quenched the fire. With many tears they singled out the whitened bones of their loved comrade and laid them within a golden urn in two layers of fat. They then covered the urn with a linen cloth and took it inside the tent. They marked off the circle where the barrow should be, made a foundation for it about the pyre, and forthwith heaped up the earth. When they had thus raised a mound, they were going away, but Achilles stayed the people and made them sit in assembly. He brought prizes from the ships, cauldrons, tripods, horses and mules, noble oxen, women with fair girdles and swart iron. The first prize he offered was for the chariot races, a woman skilled in all useful arts, and a three-legged cauldron that had ears for handles and would hold 22 measures. This was for the man who came in first. For the second there was a 6-year-old mare, unbroken, and in foal to a he-ass. The third was to have a goodly cauldron that had never yet been on the fire. It was still bright as when it left the maker, and would hold 4 measures. The fourth prize was 2 talents of gold, and the fifth a two-handled urn as yet unsoiled by smoke. Then he stood up and spoke among the Argives, saying, "Son of Atreus and all other Achaeans, these are the prizes that lie waiting the winners of the chariot races. At any other time I should carry off the first prize and take it to my own tent. You know how far my steeds excel all others, for they are immortal. Neptune gave them to my father Peleus, who in his turn gave them to myself. But I shall hold aloof, I and my steeds that have lost their brave and kind driver, who many a time has washed them in clear water and anointed their manes with oil. See how they stand, weeping there, with their manes trailing on the ground in the extremity of their sorrow. But do you others set yourselves in order throughout the host, whosoever has confidence in his horses and in the strength of his chariot." Thus spoke the son of Peleus, and the drivers of chariots bestirred themselves. First among them all uprose Eumelus, king of men, son of Admetus, a man excellent in horsemanship. Next to him rose mighty Diomed, son of Tydeus. He yoked the Trojan horses which he had taken from Aeneas when Apollo bore him out of the fight. Next to him, yellow-haired Menelaus, son of Atreus, rose and yoked his fleet horses, Agamemnon's mare, Aethe, and his own horse, Pedagus. The mare had been given to Agamemnon by Echepolus, son of Anchises, that he might not have to follow him to Ilius, but might stay at home and take his ease, for Jove had endowed him with great wealth, and he lived in spacious Sicyon. This mare, all eager for the race, did Menelaus put under the yoke. Fourth in order, Antilochus, son to noble Nestor, son of Neleus, made ready his horses. These were bred in Pylos, and his father came up to him to give him good advice, on which, however, he stood but in little need. "Antilochus," said Nestor, "you are young, but Jove and Neptune have loved you well and made you an excellent horseman. I need not, therefore, say much by way of instruction. You are skilful at wheeling your horses round the post, but the horses themselves are very slow, and it is this that will, I fear, mar your chances. The other drivers know less than you do, but their horses are fleeter. Therefore, my dear son, see if you cannot hit upon some artifice whereby you may ensure that the prize shall not slip through your fingers. The woodman does more by skill than by brute force. By skill the pilot guides his storm-tossed bark over the sea, and so by skill one driver can beat another. If a man go wide in rounding this way and that, whereas a man who knows what he is doing may have worse horses but will keep them well in hand when he sees the doubling post, he knows the precise moment at which to pull the rein and keeps his eyes well on the man in front of him. I will give you this certain token which cannot escape your notice. There is a stump of a dead tree, oak or pine as it may be, some 6 feet above the ground and not yet rotted away by rain. It stands at the fork of the road. It has 2 white stones set one on each side, and there is a clear course all round it. It may have been a monument to someone long since dead, or it may have been used as a doubling post in days gone by. Now, however, it has been fixed on by Achilles as the mark round which the chariot shall turn. Hug it as close as you can, but as you stand in your chariot, lean over a little to the left. Urge on your right-hand horse with voice and lash, and give him a loose rein, but let the left-hand horse keep so close in that the nave of your wheel shall almost graze the post. But mind the stone, or you will wound your horse and break your chariot in pieces, which would be sport for others, but confusion for yourself. Therefore, my dear son, mind well what you are about, for if you can be first around the post, there is no chance of anyone giving you the go-by later, not even though you had Adrestus's horse Arion behind you, a horse which is of divine race, or those of Laomedon, which are the noblest in this country." When Nestor had made an end of counselling his son, he sat down in his place, and fifth in order Meriones got ready his horses. They then all mounted their chariots and cast lots. Achilles shook the helmet, and the lot of Antilochus, son of Nestor, fell out first. Next came that of King Eumelus, and after his those of Menelaus, son of Atreus, and of Meriones. The last place fell to the lot of Diomed, son of Tydeus, who was the best man of them all. They took their places in line. Achilles showed them the doubling post round which they were to turn, some way off upon the plain. Here he stationed his father's follower, Phoenix, as umpire to note the running and report truly. At the same instant they all of them lashed their horses, struck them with the reins, and shouted at them with all their might.
They flew full speed over the plain, away from the ships, and dust rose from under them as it were a cloud or whirlwind, and their manes were all flying in the wind. At one moment the chariot seemed to touch the ground, and then again they bounded into the air. The drivers stood erect, and their hearts beat fast and furious in their lust of victory. Each kept calling on his horses, and the horses scoured the plain amid the clouds of dust that they raised. It was when they were doing the last part of the course on their way back towards the sea that their pace was strained to the utmost, and it was seen what each could do. The horses of the descendant of Pheres now took the lead, and close behind them came the Trojan stallions of Diomed. They seemed as if about to mount Eumelus's chariot, and he could feel their warm breath on his back and on his broad shoulders, for their heads were close to him as they flew over the course. Diomed would have now passed him, or there would have been a dead heat, but Phoebus Apollo, to spite him, made him drop his whip. Tears of anger fell from his eyes as he saw the mares going on faster than ever, while his own horses lost ground through his having no whip. Minerva saw the trick which Apollo had played the son of Tydeus, so she brought him his whip, and put spirit into his horses. Moreover, she went after the son of Admetus in a rage, and broke his yoke for him. The mares went one to one side of the course, and the other to the other, and the pole was broken against the ground. Eumelus was thrown from his chariot close to the wheel. His elbows, mouth, and nostrils were all torn, and his forehead was bruised above his eyebrows. His eyes filled with tears, and he could find no utterance. But the son of Tydeus turned his horses aside and shot far ahead, for Minerva put fresh strength into them and covered Diomed himself with glory. Menelaus, son of Atreus, came next behind him, but Antilochus called to his father's horses. "On with you both," he cried, "and do your very utmost. I do not bid you try to beat the steeds of the son of Tydeus, for Minerva has put running into them and has covered Diomed with glory, but you must overtake the horses of the son of Atreus and not be left behind, or Aethe, who is so fleet, will taunt you. Why, my good fellows, are you lagging? I tell you, and it shall surely be. Nestor will keep neither of you, but will put both of you to the sword if we win any the worse a prize through your carelessness. Fly after them at your utmost speed. I will hit on a plan for passing them in a narrow part of the way, and it shall not fail me." They feared the rebuke of their master, and for a short space went quicker. Presently Antilochus saw a narrow place where the road had sunk. The ground was broken, for the winter's rain had gathered and had worn the road, so that the whole place was deepened. Menelaus was making towards it so as to get there first, for fear of a foul, but Antilochus turned his horses out of the way and followed him a little on one side. The son of Atreus was afraid and shouted out, "Antilochus, you are driving recklessly. Rein in your horses. The road is too narrow here. It will be wider soon, and you can pass me then. If you foul my chariot, you may bring both of us to a mischief." But Antilochus plied his whip and drove faster, as though he had not heard him. They went side by side for about as far as a young man can hurl a disc from his shoulders when he is trying his strength, and then Menelaus's mares drew behind, for he left off driving for fear the horses should foul one another and upset the chariots. Thus, while pressing on in quest of victory, they might both come headlong to the ground. Menelaus then upbraided Antilochus and said, "There is no greater trickster living than you are. Go, and bad luck go with you. The Achaeans say not well that you have understanding, and come what may, you shall not bear away the prize without sworn protest on my part." Then he called on his horses and said to them, "Keep your pace and slacken not. The limbs of the other horses will weary sooner than yours, for they are neither of them young." The horses feared the rebuke of their master, and went faster, so that they were soon nearly up with the others. Meanwhile the Achaeans from their seats were watching how the horses went, as they scoured the plain amid clouds of their own dust. Idomeneus, captain of the Cretans, was first to make out the running, for he was not in the thick of the crowd, but stood on the most commanding part of the ground. The driver was a long way off, but Idomeneus could hear him shouting, and could see the foremost horse quite plainly, a chestnut with a round white star like the moon on its forehead. He stood up and said among the Argives, "My friends, princes and counsellors of the Argives, can you see the running as well as I can? There seems to be another pair in front of you now, and another driver. Those that led off at the start must have been disabled out on the plain. I saw them at first making their way round the doubling post, but now, though I search the plain of Troy, I cannot find them. Perhaps the reins fell from the driver's hand so that he lost command of his horses at the doubling post and could not turn it.
I suppose he must have been thrown out there and broken his chariot, while his mares have left the course and gone off wildly in a panic. Come up and see for yourselves. I cannot make out for certain, but the driver seems an Aetolian by descent, ruler over the Argives, brave Diomed, the son of Tydeus.
Ajax, the son of Oileus, took him up rudely and said, Idomeneus, why should you be in such a hurry to tell us all about it when the mares are still so far out upon the plain? You are none of the youngest, nor your eyes none of the sharpest, but you are always laying down the law. You have no right to do so, for there are better men here than you are. Eumelus's horses are in front now, as they have always been, and he is on the chariot holding the reins. The captain of the Cretans was angry, and answered, Ajax, you are an excellent railer, but you have no judgment, and are wanting in much else as well, for you have a vile temper. I will wager you a tripod or cauldron, and Agamemnon, son of Atreus, shall decide whose horses are first. You will then know to your cost. Ajax, son of Oileus, was for making him an angry answer, and there would have been yet further brawling between them, had not Achilles risen in his place and said, Cease your railing, Ajax and Idomeneus. It is not seemly. You would be scandalized if you saw anyone else do the like. Sit down and keep your eyes on the horses. They are speeding towards the winning post and will be here directly. You will then both of you know whose horses are first and whose come after. As he was speaking, the son of Tydeus came driving in, plying his whip lustily from his shoulder, and his horses stepping high as they flew over the course. The sand and grit rained thick on the driver, and the chariot inlaid with gold and tin ran close behind his fleet horses. There was little trace of wheel marks in the fine dust, and the horses came flying in at their utmost speed. Diomed stayed them in the middle of the crowd, and the sweat from their manes and chests fell in streams onto the ground. Forthwith he sprang from his goodly chariot and leant his whip against his horse's yoke. Brave Sthenelus now lost no time, but at once brought on the prize and gave the woman and the ear-handled cauldron to his comrades to take away. Then he unyoked the horses. Next after him came in Antilochus of the race of Neleus, who had passed Menelaus by a trick and not by the fleetness of his horses. But even so Menelaus came in as close behind him as the wheel is to the horse that draws both the chariot and its master. The end hairs of a horse's tail touch the tire of the wheel, and there is never much space between wheel and horse when the chariot is going. Menelaus was no further than this behind Antilochus, though at first he had been a full disc's throw behind him. He had soon caught him up again, for Agamemnon's mare Aethe kept pulling stronger and stronger, so that if the course had been longer he would have passed him, and there would not even have been a dead heat. Idomeneus's brave squire Meriones was about a spear's cast behind Menelaus. His horses were slowest of all, and he was the worst driver. Last of them all came the son of Admetus, dragging his chariot and driving his horses on in front. When Achilles saw him, he was sorry, and stood up among the Argives, saying, The best man is coming in last. Let us give him a prize, for it is reasonable. He shall have the second, but the first must go to the son of Tydeus. Thus did he speak, and the others, all of them, applauded his saying, and were for doing as he had said. But Nestor's son Antilochus stood up and claimed his rights from the son of Peleus. Achilles, said he, I shall take it much amiss if you do this thing. You would rob me of my prize, because you think Eumelus's chariot and horses were thrown out, and himself too, good man that he is. He should have prayed duly to the immortals. He would not have come in last if he had done so. If you are sorry for him, and so choose, you have much gold in your tents, with bronze, sheep, cattle, and horses. Take something from this store, if you would have the Achaeans speak well of you, and give him a better prize even than that which you have now offered. But I will not give up the mare, and he that will fight me for her, let him come on. Achilles smiled as he heard this, and was pleased with Antilochus, who was one of his dearest comrades. So he said, Antilochus, if you would have me find Eumelus another prize, I will give him the bronze breastplate with a rim of tin running round it, which I took from Asteropaeus. It will be worth much money to him. He bade his comrade Automedon bring the breastplate from his tent, and he did so. Achilles then gave it over to Eumelus, who received it gladly. But Menelaus got up in a rage, furiously angry with Antilochus. An attendant placed his staff in his hands and bade the Argives keep silence. The hero then addressed them. Antilochus, said he, what is this from you who have been so far blameless?
You have made me cut a poor figure and balked my horses by flinging your own in front of them, though yours are much worse than mine are. Therefore, O princes and counsellors of the Argives, judge between us and show no favour, lest one of the Achaeans say, Menelaus has got the mare through lying and corruption. His horses were far inferior to Antilochus's, but he has greater weight and influence. Nay, I will determine the matter myself, and no man will blame me, for I shall do what is just. Come here, Antilochus, and stand, as our custom is, whip in hand before your chariot and horses. Lay your hand on your steeds, and swear by earth-encircling Neptune that you did not purposely and guilefully get in the way of my horses. And Antilochus answered, Forgive me, I am much younger, King Menelaus, than you are. You stand higher than I do, and are the better man of the two. You know how easily young men are betrayed into indiscretion. Their tempers are more hasty, and they have less judgment. Make due allowance, therefore, and bear with me. I will of my own accord give up the mare that I have won, and if you claim any further chattel from my own possessions, I would rather yield it to you at once than fall from your good graces henceforth, and do wrong in the sight of heaven. The son of Nestor then took the mare and gave her over to Menelaus, whose anger was thus appeased. As when dew falls upon a field of ripening corn, and the lands are bristling with the harvest, even so, O Menelaus, was your heart made glad within you. He turned to Antilochus and said, Now, Antilochus, angry though I have been, I can give way to you of my own free will. You have never been headstrong nor ill-disposed hitherto, but this time your youth has got the better of your judgment. Be careful how you outwit your betters in future. No one else could have brought me round so easily, but your good father, your brother, and yourself have all of you had infinite trouble on my behalf. I therefore yield to your entreaty, and will give up the mare to you, mine though it indeed be. The people will thus see that I am neither harsh nor vindictive. With this he gave the mare over to Antilochus's comrade Noemon, and then took the cauldron. Meriones, who had come in fourth, carried off the 2 talents of gold, and the 5th prize, the 2-handled urn, being unawarded, Achilles gave it to Nestor, going up to him among the assembled Argives and saying, Take this, my good old friend, as an heirloom and memorial of the funeral of Patroclus, for you shall see him no more among the Argives. I give you this prize, though you cannot win one. You can now neither wrestle nor fight, and cannot enter for the javelin match nor foot races, for the hand of age has been laid heavily upon you. So saying, he gave the urn over to Nestor, who received it gladly and answered, My son, all that you have said is true. There is no strength now in my legs and feet, nor can I hit out with my hands from either shoulder. Would that I were still young and strong as when the Achaeans were burying King Amarynceus in Buprasium, and his sons offered prizes in his honour. There was then none that could vie with me, neither of the Achaeans nor the Pylians themselves, nor the Aetolians. In boxing I overcame Clytemnestra, son of Enops, and in wrestling Ancaeus of Pleuron, who had come forward against me. Iphiclus was a good runner, but I beat him, and threw farther with my spear than either Phileus or Polydorus. In chariot racing alone did the 2 sons of Actor surpass me, by crowding their horses in front of me, for they were angry at the way victory had gone, and at the greater part of the prizes remaining in the place in which they had been offered. They were twins, and the one kept on holding the reins, and holding the reins, while the other plied the whip. Such was I then. But now I must leave these matters to younger men. I must bow before the weight of years, but in those days I was eminent among heroes. And now, sir, go on with the funeral contests in honour of your comrade. Gladly do I accept this urn, and my heart rejoices that you do not forget me, but are ever mindful of my good will towards you, and of the respect due to me from the Achaeans. For all which may the grace of heaven be vouchsafed you in great abundance. Thereon the son of Peleus, when he had listened to all the thanks of Nestor, went about among the concourse of the Achaeans, and presently offered prizes for skill in the painful art of boxing. He brought out a strong mule and made it fast in the middle of the crowd, a she-mule never yet broken but 6 years old, when it is hardest of all to break them. This was for the victor, and for the vanquished he offered a double cup. Then he stood up and said among the Argives, Son of Atreus and all other Achaeans, I invite our 2 champion boxers to lay about them lustily and compete for these prizes.
He to whom Apollo vouchsafes the greater endurance, and whom the Achaeans acknowledge as victor, shall take the mule back with him to his own tent, while he that is vanquished shall have the double cup. As he spoke, there stood up a champion, both brave and of great stature, a skilful boxer, Epeius, son of Panopeus. He laid his hand on the mule and said, "Let the man who has to have the cup come hither, for none but myself will take the mule. I am the best boxer of all here present, and none can beat me. Is it not enough that I should fall short of you in actual fighting? Still, no man can be good at everything. I tell you plainly, and it shall come true. If any man will box with me, I will bruise his body and break his bones. Therefore, let his friends stay here in a body, and be at hand to take him away when I have done with him." They all held their peace, and no man rose save Euryalus, son of Mecisteus, who was the son of Talaeus. Mecisteus went once to Thebes after the fall of Oedipus to attend his funeral, and he beat all the people of Cadmus. The son of Tydeus was Euryalus's second, cheering him on and hoping heartily that he would win. First he put a waistband round him, and then he gave him some well-cut thongs of oxhide. The two men, being now girt, went into the middle of the ring, and immediately fell to. Heavily indeed did they punish one another, and lay about them with their brawny fists. One could hear the horrid crashing of their jaws, and they sweated from every pore of their skin. Presently Epeius came on, and gave Euryalus a blow on the jaw as he was looking round. Euryalus could not keep his legs. They gave way under him in a moment, and he sprang up with a bound, as a fish leaps into the air near some shore that is all bestrewn with sea-wrack, when Boreas furs the top of the waves, and then falls back into the deep water. But noble Epeius caught hold of him, and raised him up. His comrades also came round him, and led him from the ring, unsteady in his gait, his head hanging on one side, and spitting great clots of gore. They set him down in a swoon, and then went to fetch the double cup. The son of Peleus now brought out the prizes for the third contest, and showed them to the Argives. These were for the painful art of wrestling. For the winner there was a great tripod ready for setting upon the fire, and the Achaeans valued it among themselves at 12 oxen. For the loser he brought out a woman skilled in all manner of arts, and they valued her at 4 oxen. He rose and said among the Argives, "Stand forward, you who will essay this contest." Forthwith uprose great Ajax, the son of Telamon, and crafty Ulysses, full of wiles, rose also. The two girded themselves and went into the middle of the ring. They gripped each other in their strong hands like the rafters which some master builder frames for the roof of a high house to keep the wind out. Their backbones cracked as they tugged at one another with their mighty arms, and sweat rained from them in torrents. Many a bloody weal sprang up on their sides and shoulders, but they kept on striving with might and main for victory and to win the tripod. Ulysses could not throw Ajax, nor Ajax him. Ulysses was too strong for him, but when the Achaeans began to tire of watching them, Ajax said to Ulysses, "Ulysses, noble son of Laertes, you shall either lift me or I you, and let Jove settle it between us." He lifted him from the ground as he spoke, but Ulysses did not forget his cunning. He hit Ajax in the hollow at back of his knee, so that he could not keep his feet, but fell on his back, with Ulysses lying upon his chest, and all who saw it marvelled. Then Ulysses in turn lifted Ajax, and stirred him a little from the ground, but could not lift him right off it. His knee sank under him, and the two fell side by side on the ground, and were all begrimed with dust. They now sprang toward one another, and were for wrestling yet a third time, but Achilles rose and stayed them. "Put not each other further," said he, "to such cruel suffering. The victory is with both alike. Take each of you an equal prize, and let the other Achaeans now compete." Thus did he speak, and they did even as he had said, and put on their shirts again after wiping the dust from off their bodies. The son of Peleus then offered prizes for speed in running, a mixing bowl beautifully wrought of pure silver. It would hold 6 measures, and far exceeded all others in the whole world for beauty. It was the work of cunning artificers in Sidon, and had been brought into port by Phoenicians from beyond the sea, who had made a present of it to Thoas. Euenius, son of Jason, had given it to Patroclus in ransom of Priam's son Lycaon, and Achilles now offered it as a prize in honour of his comrade to him who should be the swiftest runner. For the second prize he offered a large ox, well fattened, while for the last there was to be half a talent of gold. He then rose and said among the Argives, "Stand forward, you who will essay this contest." Forthwith uprose fleet Ajax, son of Oileus, with cunning Ulysses and Nestor's son Antilochus, the fastest runner among all the youths of his time. They stood side by side, and Achilles showed them the goal. The course was set out for them from the starting post, and the son of Oileus took the lead at once, with Ulysses as close behind him as the shuttle is to a woman's bosom when she throws the woof across the warp and holds it up close to her. Even so close behind him was Ulysses, treading in his footprints before the dust could settle there, and Ajax could feel his breath on the back of his head as he ran swiftly on. The Achaeans all shouted applause as they saw him straining his utmost, and cheered him as he shot past them, but when they were now nearing the end of the course, Ulysses prayed inwardly to Minerva. "Hear me," he cried, "and help my feet, O goddess." Thus did he pray, and Pallas Minerva heard his prayer. She made his hands and his feet feel light, and when the runners were on the point of pouncing upon the prize, Ajax, through Minerva's spite, slipped upon some offal that was lying there from the cattle which Achilles had slaughtered in honour of Patroclus, and his mouth and nostrils were all filled with cow dung. Ulysses therefore carried off the mixing bowl, for he got before Ajax and came in first. But Ajax took the ox and stood with his hand on one of its horns, spitting the dung out of his mouth. Then he said to the Argives, "Alas, the goddess has spoiled my running. She watches over Ulysses and stands by him as though she were his own mother." Thus did he speak, and they all of them laughed heartily. Antilochus carried off the last prize and smiled as he said to the bystanders, "You see, my friends, that now too the gods have shown their respect for seniority. Ajax is somewhat older than I am, and as for Ulysses, he belongs to an earlier generation, but he is hale in spite of his years, and no man of the Achaeans can run against him, save only Achilles." He said this to pay a compliment to the son of Peleus, and Achilles answered, "Antilochus, you shall not have praised me to no purpose. I shall give you an additional half talent of gold." He then gave the half talent to Antilochus, who received it gladly. Then the son of Peleus brought out the spear, helmet, and shield that had been borne by Sarpedon, and were taken from him by Patroclus. He stood up and said among the Argives, "We bid two champions put on their armour, take their keen blades, and make trial of one another in the presence of the multitude. Whichever of them can first wound the flesh of the other, cut through his armour, and draw blood, to him will I give this goodly Thracian sword inlaid with silver, which I took from Asteropaeus. But the armour let both hold in partnership, and I will give each of them a hearty meal in my own tent." Forthwith uprose great Ajax, the son of Telamon, as also mighty Diomed, son of Tydeus. When they had put on their armour, each on his own side of the ring, they both went into the middle, eager to engage, and with fire flashing from their eyes. The Achaeans marvelled as they beheld them. And when the two were now close up with one another, thrice did they spring forward, and thrice try to strike each other in close combat. Ajax pierced Diomed's round shield, but did not draw blood, for the cuirass beneath the shield protected him. Thereon the son of Tydeus, from over his huge shield, kept aiming continually at Ajax's neck with the point of his spear, and the Achaeans, alarmed for his safety, bade them leave off fighting and divide the prize between them. Achilles then gave the great sword to the son of Tydeus, with its scabbard and the leathern belt with which to hang it. Achilles next offered the massive iron quoit, which mighty Eetion had erewhile been used to hurl, until Achilles had slain him and carried it off in his ships among with other spoils. He stood up and said among the Argives, "Stand forward, you who would essay this contest. He who wins it will have a store of iron that will last him 5 years as they go rolling round, and if his fair fields lie far from a town, his shepherd or ploughman will not have to make a journey to buy iron, for he will have a stock of it on his own premises." Then uprose the two mighty men Polypoetes and Leonteus, with Ajax son of Telamon and noble Epeius. They stood up one after the other, and Epeius took the quoit, whirled it, and flung it from him, which set all the Achaeans laughing. After him threw Leonteus of the race of Mars. Ajax, son of Telamon, threw third and sent the quoit beyond any mark that had been made yet. But when mighty Polypoetes took the quoit, he hurled it as though it had been a stockman's stick, which he sends flying about among his cattle when he is driving them. So far did his throw outdistance those of the others. All who saw it roared applause, and his comrades carried the prize for him and set it on board his ship. Achilles next offered a prize of iron for archery, 10 double-edged axes and 10 with single edges. He set up a ship's mast some way off upon the sands, and with a fine string tied a pigeon to it by the foot. This was what they were to aim at. Whoever, he said, can hit the pigeon shall have all the axes and take them away with him. He who hits the string without hitting the bird will have taken a worse aim and shall have the single-edged axes. Then uprose King Teucer, and Meriones, the stalwart squire of Idomeneus, rose also. They cast lots in a bronze helmet, and the lot of Teucer fell first. He let fly with his arrow forthwith, but he did not promise hecatombs of firstling lambs to King Apollo, and missed his bird, for Apollo foiled his aim. But he hid the string with which the bird was tied near its foot. The arrow cut the string clean through, so that it hung down towards the ground, while the bird flew up into the sky, and the Achaeans shouted applause. Meriones, who had his arrow ready while Teucer was aiming, snatched the bow out of his hand, and at once promised that he would sacrifice a hecatomb of firstling lambs to Apollo, lord of the bow. Then, espying the pigeon high up under the clouds, he hit her in the middle of the wing as she was circling upwards. The arrow went clean through the wing and fixed itself in the ground at Meriones' feet, but the bird perched on the ship's mast, hanging her head and with all her feathers drooping. The life went out of her, and she fell heavily from the mast. Meriones, therefore, took all 10 double-edged axes, while Teucer bore off the single-edged ones to his ships. Then the son of Peleus brought in a spear and a cauldron that had never been on the fire. It was worth an ox, and was chased with a pattern of flowers, and those that throw the javelin stood up, to wit the son of Atreus, king of men, Agamemnon, and Meriones, stalwart squire of Idomeneus. But Achilles spoke, saying, "Son of Atreus, we know how far you excel all others, both in power and in throwing the javelin. Take the cauldron back with you to your ships, but if it so please you, let us give the spear to Meriones. This at least is what I should myself wish." King Agamemnon assented. So he gave the bronze spear to Meriones, and handed the goodly cauldron to Talthybius, his esquire. End of section 23. Section 24 of the Iliad by Homer, translated by Samuel Butler. Book 24. Priam ransoms the body of Hector. Hector's funeral. The assembly now broke up, and the people went their ways, each to his own ship. There they made ready their supper, and then bethought them of the blessed boon of sleep. But Achilles still wept for thinking of his dear comrade, and sleep, before whom all things bow, could take no hold upon him. This way and that did he turn, as he yearned after the might and manfulness of Patroclus. He thought of all they had done together, and all they had gone through, both on the field of battle and on the waves of the weary sea. As he dwelt on these things, he wept bitterly, and lay now on his side, now on his back, and now face downwards, till at last he rose and went out as one distraught to wander upon the seashore. Then, when he saw dawn breaking over beach and sea, he yoked his horses to his chariot, and bound the body of Hector behind it, that he might drag it about. Thrice did he drag it round the tomb of the son of Menoetius, and then went back into his tent, leaving the body on the ground full length and with its face downwards. But Apollo would not suffer it to be disfigured, for he pitied the man, dead though he now was. Therefore he shielded him with his golden aegis continually, that he might take no hurt while Achilles was dragging him. Thus shamefully did Achilles in his fury dishonour Hector. But the blessed gods looked down in pity from heaven, and urged Mercury, slayer of Argus, to steal the body. All were of this mind, save only Juno, Neptune, and Jove's grey-eyed daughter, who persisted in the hate which they had ever borne towards Ilius with Priam and his people. For they forgave not the wrong done them by Alexandrus in disdaining the goddesses who came to him when he was in his sheepyards, and preferring her who had offered him a wanton to his ruin.
When, therefore, the morning of the 12th day had now come, Phoebus Apollo spoke among the immortals, saying, "You gods ought to be ashamed of yourselves. You are cruel and hard-hearted. Did not Hector burn you thigh-bones of heifers and of unblemished goats? And now dare you not rescue even his dead body for his wife to look upon, with his mother and child, his father Priam, and his people, who would forthwith commit him to the flames and give him his due funeral rites? So then would you all be on the side of mad Achilles, who knows neither right nor ruth? He is like some savage lion that in the pride of his great strength and daring springs upon men's flocks and gorges on them. Even so has Achilles flung aside all pity, and all that conscience, which at once so greatly banes, yet greatly boons him that will heed it. A man may lose one far dearer than Achilles has lost, a son it may be, or a brother born of his own mother's womb, yet when he has mourned him and wept over him, he will let him bide, for it takes much sorrow to kill a man. Whereas Achilles, now that he has slain noble Hector, drags him behind his chariot round the tomb of his comrade. It were better of him, and for him, that he should not do so, for brave though he be, we gods may take it ill that he should vent his fury upon dead clay." Juno spoke up in a rage. "This were well," she cried, "O Lord of the Silver Bow, if you would give like honour to Hector and to Achilles. But a Hector was mortal and suckled at a woman's breast, whereas Achilles is the offspring of a goddess, whom I myself reared and brought up. I married her to Peleus, who is above measure dear to the immortals. You gods came all of you to her wedding. You feasted along with them yourself, and brought your lyre, false and fond of low company that you have ever been." Then said Jove, "Juno, be not so bitter. Their honour shall not be equal, but of all that dwells in Ilius, Hector was dearest to the gods, and also to myself, for his offerings never failed me. Never was my altar stinted of its dues, nor of the drink offerings and savour of sacrifice which we claim of right. I shall therefore permit the body of mighty Hector to be stolen, and yet this may hardly be without Achilles coming to know it, for his mother keeps night and day beside him. Let some one of you, therefore, send Thetis to me, and I will impart my counsel to her, namely, that Achilles is to accept a ransom from Priam, and give up the body." On this Iris, fleet as the wind, went forth to carry his message. Down she plunged into the dark sea, midway between Samos and rocky Imbrus. The waters hissed as they closed over her, and she sank into the bottom of the lead at the end of an ox-horn that is sped to carry death to fishes. She found Thetis sitting in a great cave with the other sea-goddesses gathered round her. There she sat in the midst of them, weeping for her noble son, who was to fall far from his own land on the rich plains of Troy. Iris went up to her and said, "Rise, Thetis. Jove, whose counsels fail not, bids you come to him." And Thetis answered, "Why does the mighty god so bid me? I am in great grief, and shrink from going in and out among the immortals. Still, I will go, and the word that he may speak shall not be spoken in vain." The goddess took her dark veil, than which there can be no robe more sombre, and went forth, with fleet Iris leading the way before her. The waves of the sea opened them a path, and when they reached the shore they flew up into the heavens, where they found the all-seeing son of Saturn with the blessed gods that live for ever assembled near him. Minerva gave up her seat to her, and she sat down by the side of Father Jove. Juno then placed a fair golden cup in her hand, and spoke to her in words of comfort, whereon Thetis drank and gave her back the cup, and the sire of gods and men was the first to speak. "So, goddess," said he, "for all your sorrow and the grief that I well know reigns ever in your heart, you have come hither to Olympus, and I will tell you why I have sent for you. This 9 days past, the immortals have been quarrelling about Achilles, waster of cities, and the body of Hector. The gods would have Mercury, slayer of Arcas, steal the body, but in furtherance of our peace and amity henceforward, I will concede such honour to your son as I will now tell you. Go then to the host, and lay these commands upon him. Say that the gods are angry with him, and that I am myself more angry than them all, in that he keeps Hector at the ships and will not give him up. He may thus fear me and let the body go.
At the same time, I will send Iris to great Priam to bid him go to the ships of the Achaeans and ransom his son, taking with him such gifts for Achilles as may give him satisfaction. Silver-footed Thetis did as the god had told her, and forthwith down she darted from the topmost summits of Olympus. She went to her son's tents, where she found him grieving bitterly, while his trusty comrades round him were busy preparing their morning meal, for which they had killed a great woolly sheep. His mother sat down beside him and caressed him with her hand, saying, "My son, how long will you keep on thus grieving and making moan? You are gnawing at your own heart, and think neither of food nor of woman's embraces. And yet these two were well, for you have no long time to live, and death with the strong hand of fate are already close beside you. Now, therefore, heed what I say, for I come as a messenger from Jove. He says that the gods are angry with you, and himself more angry than them all, in that you keep Hector at the ships and will not give him up. Therefore, let him go, and accept a ransom for his body." And Achilles answered, "So be it. If Olympian Jove of his own motion thus commands me, let him that brings the ransom bear the body away." Thus did his mother and son talk together at the ships in long discourse with one another. Meanwhile the son of Saturn sent Iris to the strong city of Ilius. "Go," said he, "fleet Iris, from the mansions of Olympus, and tell King Priam in Ilius that he is to go to the ships of the Achaeans and free the body of his dear son. He is to take such gifts with him as shall give satisfaction to Achilles, and he is to go alone, with no other Trojan, save only some honoured servant who may drive his mules and wagon, and bring back the body of him whom noble Achilles has slain. Let him have no thought nor fear of death in his heart, for we will send the slayer of Argus to escort him, and bring him within the tent of Achilles. Achilles will not kill him, nor let another do so, for he will take heed to his ways and sin not, and he will entreat a suppliant with all honourable courtesy." On this, Iris, fleet as the wind, sped forth to deliver her message. She went to Priam's house, and found weeping and lamentation therein. His sons were seated round their father in the outer courtyard, and their raiment was wet with tears. The old man sat in the midst of them, with his mantle wrapped close about his body, and his head and neck all covered with the filth which he had clutched as he lay grovelling in the mire. His daughters and his sons' wives went wailing about the house, as they thought of the many and brave men who lay dead, slain by the Argives. The messenger of Jove stood by Priam and spoke softly to him, but fear fell upon him as she did so. "Take heart," she said, "Priam, offspring of Dardanus, take heart and fear not. I bring no evil tidings, but am minded well towards you. I come as a messenger from Jove, who, though he be not near, takes thought for you and pities you. The lord of Olympus bids you go and ransom noble Hector, and take with you such gifts as shall give satisfaction to Achilles. You are to go alone, with no Trojan, save only some honoured servant who may drive your mules and wagon, and bring back to the city the body of him whom noble Achilles has slain. You are to have no thought nor fear of death, for Jove will send the slayer of Argus to escort you. When he has brought you within Achilles' tent, Achilles will not kill you, nor let another do so, for he will take heed to his ways and sin not, and will entreat a suppliant with all honourable courtesy." Iris went her way when she had thus spoken, and Priam told his sons to get a mule wagon ready, and to make the body of the wagon fast upon the top of its bed. Then he went down into his fragrant storeroom, high-vaulted and made of cedar wood, where his many treasures were kept, and he called Hecuba, his wife. "Wife," said he, "a messenger has come to me from Olympus, and has told me to go to the ships of the Achaeans to ransom my dear son, taking with me such gifts as shall give satisfaction to Achilles. What think you of this matter? For my own part, I am greatly moved to pass through the camps of the Achaeans and go to their ships." His wife cried aloud as she heard him, and said, "Alas, what has become of that judgment for which you have been ever famous, both among strangers and your own people? How can you venture alone to the ships of the Achaeans, and look into the face of him who has slain so many of your brave sons? You must have iron courage, for if the cruel savage sees you and lays hold on you, he will know neither respect nor pity. Let us then weep Hector from afar, here in our own house. For when I gave him birth, the threads of overruling fate were spun for him, that dogs should eat his flesh far from his parents, in the house of that terrible man, on whose liver I would fain fasten and devour it. Thus would I avenge my son, who showed no cowardice when Achilles slew him, and thought neither of flight nor of avoiding battle, as he stood in defence of Trojan men and Trojan women. Then Priam said, I would go. Do not therefore stay me, nor be as a bird of ill omen in my house, for you will not move me. Had it been some mortal man who had sent me some prophet or priest who divines from sacrifice, I should have deemed him false, and have given him no heed. But now I have heard the goddess, and seen her face to face. Therefore I will go, and her saying shall not be in vain. If it be my fate to die at the ships of the Achaeans, even so would I have it. Let Achilles slay me, if I may but first have taken my son in my arms and mourned him to my heart's comforting. So saying, he lifted the lids of his chests and took out 12 goodly vestments. He took also 12 cloaks of single fold, 12 rugs, 12 fair mantles, and an equal number of shirts. He weighed out 10 talents of gold, and brought, moreover, 2 burnished tripods, 4 cauldrons, and a very beautiful cup which the Thracians had given him when he had gone to them on an embassy. It was very precious, but he grudged not even this, so eager was he to ransom the body of his son. Then he chased all the Trojans from the court, and rebuked them with words of anger. Out, he cried, shame and disgrace to me that you are. Have you no grief in your own homes that you are come to plague me here? Is it a small thing, think you, that the son of Saturn has sent this sorrow upon me, to lose the bravest of my sons? Nay, you shall prove it in person, for now he is gone, the Achaeans will have easier work in killing you. As for me, let me go down within the house of Hades, ere mine eyes behold the sacking and wasting of the city. He drove the men away with his staff, and they went forth as the old man sped them. Then he called to his sons, upbraiding Helenus, Paris, noble Agathon, Pammon, Antiphonus, Polites of the loud battle cry, Deiphobus, Hippothous, and Dius. These 9 did the old man call near him. Come to me at once, he cried, worthless sons who do me shame. Would that you had all been killed at the ships rather than Hector. Miserable man that I am, I have had the bravest sons in all Troy. Noble Nestor, Troilus, the dauntless charioteer, and Hector, who is a god among men, so that one would have thought he was son to an immortal, yet there is not one of them left. Mars has slain them, and those of whom I am ashamed are alone left me. Liars and light of foot, heroes of the dance, robbers of lambs and kids from your own people, why do you not get a wagon ready for me at once, and put all these things upon it, that I may set out on my way? Thus did he speak, and they feared the rebuke of their father. They brought out a strong mule wagon, newly made, and set the body of the wagon fast on its bed. They took the mule yoke from the peg on which it hung, a yoke of boxwood with a knob on the top of it, and rings for the reins to go through. Then they brought a yoke band 11 cubits long to bind the yoke to the pole. They bound it on at the far end of the pole, and put the ring over the upright pin, making it fast with 3 turns of the band on either side of the knob, and bending the thong of the yoke beneath it. This done, they brought from the store chamber the rich ransom that was to purchase the body of Hector, and they set it all orderly on the wagon. Then they yoked the strong harness mules which the Mycians had on a time given as a goodly present to Priam, but for Priam himself they yoked horses which the old king had bred and kept for his own use. Thus heedfully did Priam and his servant see to the yoking of their cars at the palace. Then Hecuba came to them all sorrowful, with a golden goblet of wine in her right hand, that they might make a drink offering before they set out. She stood in front of the horses and said, Take this, make a drink offering to Father Jove. And since you are minded to go to the ships in spite of me, pray that you may come safely back from the hands of your enemies. Pray to the son of Saturn, lord of the whirlwind, who sits on Ida and looks down on all Troy. Pray him to send his swift messenger on your right hand, the bird of omen, which is strongest and most dear to him of all birds, that you may see it with your own eyes and trust it as you go forth to the ships of the Danaans. If all-seeing Jove will not send you this messenger, however, set upon it you may be. I would not have you go to the ships of the Argives. And Priam answered, "Wife, I will do as you desire me. It is well to lift hands in prayers to Jove, if so be he may have mercy upon me." With this the old man bade the serving woman pour pure water over his hands, and the woman came, bearing the water in a bowl. He washed his hands, and took the cup from his wife. Then he made the drink offering, and prayed, standing in the middle of the courtyard, and turning his eyes to heaven. "Father Jove," he said, "that rulest from Ida, most glorious and most great, grant that I may be received kindly and compassionately in the tents of Achilles. And send your swift messenger upon my right hand, the bird of omen, which is strongest and most dear to you of all birds, that I may see it with my own eyes, and trust it as I go forth to the ships of the Danaans." So did he pray, and Jove, the lord of counsel, heard his prayer. Forthwith he sent an eagle, the most unerring portent of all birds that fly, the dusky hunter that men also call the black eagle. His wings were spread abroad on either side, as wide as the well-made and well-bolted door of a rich man's chamber. He came to them flying over the city upon their right hands, and when they saw him they were glad, and their hearts took comfort within them. The old man made haste to mount his chariot, and drove out through the inner gateway and under the echoing gatehouse of the outer court. Before him went the mules drawing the four-wheeled wagon, and driven by wise Idaeus. Behind these were the horses, which the old man lashed with his whip, and drove swiftly through the city, while his friends followed after, wailing and lamenting for him as though he were on his road to death. As soon as they had come down from the city and had reached the plain, his sons and sons-in-law who had followed him went back to Ilius. But Priam and Idaeus, as they showed out upon the plain, did not escape the ken of all-seeing Jove, who looked down upon the old man and pitied him. Then he spoke to his son Mercury and said, "Mercury, for it is you who are the most disposed to escort men on their way and to hear those whom you will hear, go, and so conduct Priam to the ships of the Achaeans that no other of the Danaans shall see him nor take note of him until he reach the son of Peleus." Thus he spoke, and Mercury, guide and guardian, slayer of Argus, did as he was told. Forthwith he bound on his glittering golden sandals, with which he could fly like the wind over land and sea. He took the wand with which he seals men's eyes in sleep, and wakes them just as he pleases, and flew, holding it in his hand, till he came to Troy and to the Hellespont. To look at, he was like a young man of noble birth in the heyday of his youth and beauty, with the down just coming upon his face. Now when Priam and Idaeus had driven past the great tomb of Ilius, they stayed their mules and horses, that they might drink in the river, for the shades of night were falling. When, therefore, Idaeus saw Mercury standing near them, he said to Priam, "Take heed, descendant of Dardanus, here is matter which demands consideration. I see a man who I think will presently fall upon us. Let us fly with our horses, or at least embrace his knees, and employ him to take compassion upon us." When he heard this, the old man's heart failed him, and he was in great fear. He stayed where he was as one dazed, and the hair stood on end over his whole body. But the bringer of good luck came up to him and took him by the hand, saying, "Whither, father, are you driving your mules and horses in the dead of night when other men are asleep? Are you not afraid of the fierce Achaeans who are hard by you, so cruel and relentless? Should some one of them see you bearing so much treasure through the darkness of the flying night, what would not your state then be? You are no longer young, and he who is with you is too old to protect you from those who would attack you. For myself, I will do you no harm, and I will defend you from any one else, for you remind me of my own father." And Priam answered, "It is indeed as you say, my dear son. Nevertheless, some god has held his hand over me, in that he has sent such a wayfarer as yourself to meet me so opportunely. You are so comely in mien and figure, and your judgment is so excellent, that you must come of blessed parents." Then said the slayer of Argus, guide and guardian, "Sir, all that you have said is right. But tell me, and tell me true, are you taking this rich treasure to send it to a foreign people, where it may be safe, or are you leaving strong Ilius in dismay, now that your son has fallen, who was the bravest man among you, and was never lacking in battle with the Achaeans?" And Priam said, "Who are you, my friend, and who are your parents, that you speak so truly about the fate of my unhappy son?" The slayer of Argus, guide and guardian, answered him, "Sir, you would prove me that you question me about noble Hector. Many a time have I set eyes upon him in battle when he was driving the Argives to their ships and putting them to the sword. We stood still and marvelled, for Achilles in his anger with the son of Atreus suffered us not to fight. I am his squire and came with him in the same ship. I am a myrmidon, and my father's name is Polyctor. He is a rich man and about as old as you are. He has 6 sons beside myself, and I am the 7th. We cast lots, and it fell upon me to sail hither with Achilles. I am now come from the ships onto the plain, for with daybreak the Achaeans will set battle in array about the city. They chafe at doing nothing, and are so eager that their prince cannot hold them back." Then answered Priam, "If you are indeed the squire of Achilles, son of Peleus, tell me now the whole truth. Is my son still at the ships, or has Achilles hewn him limb from limb and given him to his hounds?" "Sire," replied the slayer of Argus, guide and guardian, "neither hounds nor vultures have yet devoured him. He is still just lying at the tents by the ship of Achilles, and though it is now 12 days that he has lain there, his flesh is not wasted, nor have the worms eaten him, although they feed on warriors. At daybreak Achilles drags him cruelly round the sepulchre of his dear comrade, but it does him no hurt. You should come yourself and see how he lies fresh as dew, with the blood all washed away, and his wounds every one of them closed, though many pierced him with their spears. Such care have the blessed gods taken of your brave son, for he was dear to them beyond all measure." The old man was comforted as he heard him, and said, "My son, see what a good thing it is to have made due offerings to the immortals, for as sure as that he was born, my son never forgot the gods that hold Olympus, and now they requite it to him even in death. Accept, therefore, at my hands this goodly chalice. Guard me, and with heaven's help guide me till I come to the tent of the son of Peleus." Then answered the slayer of Argus, guide and guardian, "Sir, you are tempting me and playing upon my youth, but you shall not move me, for you are offering me presents without the knowledge of Achilles, whom I fear and hold it great guilt to defraud, lest some evil presently befall me. But as your guide I would go with you even to Argos itself, and would guard you so carefully, whether by sea or land, that no one should attack you through making light of him who was with you." The bringer of good luck then sprang on to the chariot, and seizing the whip and reins, he breathed fresh spirit into the mules and horses. When they reached the trench and the wall that was before the ships, those who were on guard had just been getting their suppers, and the slayer of Argus threw them all into a deep sleep. Then he drew back the bolts to open the gates, and took Priam inside with the treasure he had upon his wagon. Ere long they came to the lofty dwelling of the son of Peleus, for which the Myrmidons had cut pine, and which they had built for their king. When they had built it, they had thatched it with coarse tussock grass, which they had mown out on the plain, and all round it they made a large courtyard, which was fenced with stakes set close together. The gate was barred with a single bolt of pine, which it took 3 men to force into its place, and 3 to draw back so as to open the gate, but Achilles could draw it by himself. Mercury opened the gate for the old man, and brought in the treasure that he was taking with him for the son of Peleus. Then he sprang from the chariot onto the ground, and said, "Sir, it is I, immortal Mercury, that am come with you, for my father sent me to escort you. I will now leave you, and will not enter into the presence of Achilles, for it might anger him that a god should befriend mortal men thus openly. Go you within, and embrace the knees of the son of Peleus. Beseech him, by his father, his lovely mother, and his son, that you may move him." With these words Mercury went back to high Olympus. Priam sprang from his chariot to the ground, leaving a dais where he was, in charge of the mules and horses. The old man went straight into the house where Achilles, loved of the gods, was sitting. There he found him with his men seated at a distance from him. Only 2, the hero Automedon and Alcimus of the race of Mars, were busy in attendance about his person, for he had but just done eating and drinking, and the table was still there. King Priam entered without their seeing him, and going right up to Achilles, he clasped his knees and kissed the dread, murderous hands that had slain so many of his sons. As when some cruel spite has befallen a man that he should have killed some one in his own country, and must fly to a great man's protection in a land of strangers, and all marvel who see him. Even so did Achilles marvel as he beheld Priam. The others looked one to another and marvelled also, but Priam besought Achilles, saying, Think of your father, O Achilles, like unto the gods, who is such even as I am, on the sad threshold of old age. It may be that those who dwell near him harass him, and there is none to keep war and ruin from him. Yet when he hears of you being still alive, he is glad, and his days are full of hope that he shall see his dear son come home to him from Troy. But I, wretched man that I am, had the bravest in all Troy for my sons, and there is not one of them left. I had 50 sons when the Achaeans came here. 19 of them were from a single womb, and the others were born to me by the women of my household. The greater part of them has fierce Mars laid low, and Hector, him who was alone left, him who was the guardian of the city and of ourselves, him have you lately slain. Therefore I am now come to the ships of the Achaeans to ransom his body from you with a great ransom. Fear, O Achilles, the wrath of heaven. Think on your own father, and have compassion upon me, who am more pitiable. For I have steeled myself as no man yet has ever steeled himself before me, and have raised to my lips the hand of him who slew my son. Thus spoke Priam. And the heart of Achilles yearned as he bethought him of his father. He took the old man's hand and moved him gently away. The two wept bitterly, Priam as he lay at Achilles' feet, weeping for Hector, and Hector now for his father, and now for Patroclus, till the house was filled with their lamentations. But when Achilles was now sated with grief and had unburthened the bitterness of his sorrow, he left his seat and raised the old man by the hand, in pity for his white hair and beard. Then he said, Unhappy man, you have indeed been greatly daring. How could you venture to come alone to the ships of the Achaeans, and enter the presence of him who has slain so many of your brave sons? You must have iron courage. Sit now upon this seat, and for all our grief we will hide our sorrows in our hearts, for weeping will not avail us. The immortals know no care, yet the lot they spin for man is full of sorrow. On the floor of Jove's palace there stand two urns, the one filled with evil gifts and the other with good ones. He for whom Jove, the Lord of Thunder, mixes the gifts he sends will meet now with good and now with evil fortune, but he to whom Jove sends none but evil gifts will be pointed at by the finger of scorn. The hand of famine will pursue him to the ends of the world, and he will go up and down the face of the earth, respected neither by gods nor men. Even so did it befall Peleus. The gods endowed him with all good things from his birth upwards, for he reigned over the Myrmidons, excelling all men in prosperity and wealth, and mortal though he was, they gave him a goddess for his bride. But even on him too did heaven send misfortune, for there is no race of royal children born to him in his house, save one son who is doomed to die all untimely. Nor may I take care of him now that he is growing old, for I must stay here at Troy to be the bane of you and your children. And you too, O Priam, I have heard that you were aforetime happy. They say that in wealth and plenitude of offspring you surpassed all that is in Lesbos, the realm of Makar to the northward, Phrygia that is more inland, and those that dwell upon the great Hellespont. But from the day when the dwellers in heaven sent this evil upon you, war and slaughter have been about your city continually. Bear up against it, and let there be some intervals in your sorrow. Mourn as you may for your brave son, for you will take nothing by it. You cannot raise him from the dead. Ere you do so, yet another sorrow shall befall you. And Priam answered, O king, bid me not be seated while Hector is still lying uncared for in your tents, but accept the great ransom which I have brought you, and give him to me at once, that I may look upon him. May you prosper with the ransom, and reach your own land in safety, seeing that you have suffered me to live and look upon the light of the sun. Achilles looked at him sternly and said, Vex me, sir, no longer. I am of myself minded to give up the body of Hector.
My mother, daughter of the old man of the sea, came to me from Jove to bid me deliver it to you. Moreover, I know well, O Priam, and you cannot hide it, that some god has brought you to the ships of the Achaeans, for else no man, however strong and in his prime, would dare to come to our host. He could neither pass our guard unseen nor draw the bolt of my gates thus easily. Therefore provoke me no further, lest I sin against the word of Jove, and suffer you not, suppliant though you are, within my tents. The old man feared him and obeyed. Then the son of Peleus sprang like a lion through the door of his house, not alone, but with him went his two squires, Automedon and Alcimus, who were closer to him than any others of his comrades, now that Patroclus was no more. These unyoked the horses and mules, and bade Priam's herald and attendant be seated within the house. They lifted the ransom for Hector's body from the wagon, but they left two mantles and a goodly shirt, that Achilles might wrap the body in them when he gave it to be taken home. Then he called to his servants and ordered them to wash the body and anoint it, but he first took it to a place where Priam should not see it, lest, if he did so, he should break out in the bitterness of his grief and enrage Achilles, who might then kill him and sin against the word of Jove. When the servants had washed the body and anointed it and had wrapped it in a fair shirt and mantle, Achilles himself lifted it onto a bier, and he and his men then laid it on the wagon. He cried aloud as he did so, and called on the name of his dear comrade. "Be not angry with me, Patroclus," he said, "if you hear, even in the house of Hades, that I have given Hector to his father for a ransom. It has been no unworthy one, and I will share it equitably with you." Achilles then went back into the tent and took his place on the richly inlaid seat from which he had risen, by the wall that was at right angles to the one against which Priam was sitting. "Sir," he said, "your son is now laid upon his bier and is ransomed according to desire. You shall look upon him when you take him away at daybreak. For the present, let us prepare our supper. Even lovely Niobe had to think about eating, though her 12 children, 6 daughters and 6 lusty sons, had been all slain in her house. Apollo killed the sons with arrows from his silver bow to punish Niobe, and Diana slew the daughters, because Niobe had vaunted herself against Leto. She said Leto had borne 2 children only, whereas she had herself borne many, whereon the 2 killed the many. 9 days did they lie weltering, and there was none to bury them, for the son of Saturn turned the people into stone. But on the 10th day the gods in heaven themselves buried them, and Niobe then took food, being worn out with weeping. They say that somewhere among the rocks on the mountain pastures of Sipylus, where the nymphs live that haunt the river Achelous, there, they say, she lives in stone and still nurses the sorrows sent upon her by the hand of heaven. Therefore, noble sir, let us too now take food. You can weep for your dear son hereafter, as you are bearing him back to Ilius, and many a tear will he cost you." With this Achilles sprang from his seat and killed a sheep of silvery whiteness, which his followers skinned and made ready all in due order. They cut the meat carefully up into smaller pieces, spitted them, and drew them off again when they were well roasted. Automedon brought bread in fair baskets and served it round the table, while Achilles dealt out the meat, and they laid their hands on the good things that were before them. As soon as they had had enough to eat and drink, Priam, descendant of Dardanus, marvelled at the strength and beauty of Achilles, for he was as a god to see, and Achilles marvelled at Priam as he listened to him and looked upon his noble presence. When they had gazed their fill, Priam spoke first. "And now, O king," he said, "take me to my couch, that we may lie down and enjoy the blessed boon of sleep. Never once have my eyes been closed from the day your hands took the life of my son. I have grovelled without ceasing in the mire of my stable-yard, making moan and brooding over my countless sorrows. Now, moreover, I have eaten bread and drunk wine. Hitherto I have tasted nothing." As he spoke, Achilles told his men and the women servants to set beds in the room that was in the gatehouse, and make them with good red rugs, and spread coverlets on the top of them with woollen cloaks for Priam and Idaeus to wear. So the maids went out carrying a torch, and got the 2 beds ready in all haste. Then Achilles said laughingly to Priam, "Dear sir, you shall lie outside, lest some counsellor of those who in due course keep coming to advise with me should see you here in the darkness of the flying night, and tell it to Agamemnon. This might cause delay in the delivery of the body." And now tell me, and tell me true, for how many days would you celebrate the funeral rites of noble Hector? Tell me, that I may hold aloof from war and restrain the host. And Priam answered, Since then you suffer me to bury my noble son with all due rites, do thus, Achilles, and I shall be grateful. You know how we are pent up within our city. It is far for us to fetch wood from the mountains, and the people live in fear. 9 days, therefore, will we mourn Hector in my house. On the 10th day we will bury him, and there shall be a public feast in his honour. On the 11th we will build a mound over his ashes, and on the 12th, if there be need, we will fight. And Achilles answered, All, King Priam, shall be as you have said. I will stay our fighting for as long a time as you have named. As he spoke, he laid his hand on the old man's right wrist, in token that he should have no fear. Thus then did Priam and his attendants sleep there in the forecourt, full of thought, while Achilles lay in an inner room of the house, with the fair Briseis by his side. And now both gods and mortals were fast asleep through the livelong night, but upon Mercury alone, the bringer of good luck, sleep could take no hold, for he was thinking all the time how to get King Priam away from the ships without his being seen by the strong force of sentinels. He hovered, therefore, over Priam's head, and said, Sir, now that Achilles has spared your life, you seem to have no fear about sleeping in the thick of your foes. You have paid a great ransom, and have received the body of your son. Were you still alive and a prisoner, the sons whom you have left at home would have to give 3 times as much to free you, and so it would be if Agamemnon and the other Achaeans were to know of your being here. When he heard this, the old man was afraid, and roused his servant. Mercury then yoked their horses and mules, and drove them quickly through the host, so that no man perceived them. When they came to the ford of eddying Xanthus, begotten of immortal Jove, Mercury went back to high Olympus, and dawn, in robe of saffron, began to break all over the land. Priam and Idaeus then drove on towards the city, lamenting and making moan, and the mules drew the body of Hector. No one, neither man nor woman, saw them, till Cassandra, fair as golden Venus, standing on Pergamus, caught sight of her dear father in his chariot, and his servant that was the city's herald with him. Then she saw him that was lying upon the bier, drawn by the mules, and with a loud cry she went about the city, saying, Come hither, Trojans, men and women, and look on Hector. If ever you rejoiced to see him coming from battle when he was alive, look now on him that was the glory of our city and all our people. At this there was not man nor woman left in the city, so great a sorrow had possessed them. Hard by the gates they met Priam as he was bringing in the body. Hector's wife and his mother were the first to mourn him. They flew towards the wagon and laid their hands upon his head while the crowd stood weeping around them. They would have stayed before the gates, weeping and lamenting the livelong day to the going down of the sun, had not Priam spoken to them from the chariot, and said, Make way for the mules to pass you. Afterwards, when I have taken the body home, you shall have your fill of weeping. On this the people stood asunder and made a way for the wagon. When they had borne the body within the house, they laid it upon a bed, and seated minstrels round it to lead the dirge, whereon the women joined in the sad music of their lament. Foremost among them all, Andromache led their wailing as she clasped the head of mighty Hector in her embrace. Husband, she cried, you have died young, and leave me in your house a widow. He of whom we are the ill-starred parents is still a mere child, and I fear he may not reach manhood. Ere he can do so, our city will be razed and overthrown, for you who watched over it are no more, you who were its saviour, the guardian of our wives and children. Our women will be carried away captive to the ships, and I among them, while you, my child, who will be with me, will be put to some unseemly tasks, working for a cruel master. Or may be some Achaean will hurl you, O miserable death, from our walls, to avenge some brother, son, or father whom Hector slew. Many of them have indeed bitten the dust at his hands, for your father's hand in battle was no light one. Therefore did the people mourn him. You have left, O Hector, sorrow unutterable to your parents, and my own grief is greatest of all, for you did not stretch forth your arm and embrace me as you lay dying, nor say to me any words that might have lived with me in my tears night and day for evermore. Bitterly did she weep the while, and the women joined in her lament. Hecuba, in her turn, took up the strains of woe. "Hector," she cried, "the dearest to me of all my children, so long as you were alive, the gods loved you well, and even in death they have not been utterly unmindful of you, for when Achilles took any other of my sons, he would sell him beyond the seas, to Samos, Imbros, or rugged Lemnos, and when he had slain you too with his sword, many a time did he drag you round the sepulchre of his comrade, though this could not give him life, and yet you lie all fresh as dew, and comely as one whom Apollo has slain with his painless shafts." Thus did she too speak through her tears with bitter moan, and then Helen for a third time took up the strain of lamentation. "Hector," said she, "dearest of all my brothers-in-law, for I am wife to Alexandrus who brought me hither to Troy, would that I had died ere he did so. 20 years have come and gone since I left my home and came from over the seas, but I have never heard one word of insult or unkindness from you. When another would chide with me, as it might be one of your brothers or sisters, or of your brothers' wives, or my mother-in-law, for Priam was as kind to me as though he were my own father, you would rebuke and check them with words of gentleness and goodwill. Therefore my tears flow both for you and for my unhappy self, for there is no one else in Troy who is kind to me, but all shrink and shudder as they go by me." She wept as she spoke, and the vast crowd that was gathered round her joined in her lament. Then King Priam spoke to them, saying, "Bring wood, O Trojans, to the city, and fear no cunning ambush of the Argives. For Achilles, when he dismissed me from the ships, gave me word that they should not attack us until the morning of the 12th day. Forthwith they yoked their oxen and mules, and gathered together before the city. 9 days long did they bring in great heaps of wood, and on the morning of the 10th day, with many tears, they took brave Hector forth, laid his dead body upon the summit of the pile, and set the fire thereto. Then, when the child of morning, rosy-fingered Dawn, appeared on the 11th day, the people again assembled round the pyre of mighty Hector. When they were got together, they first quenched the fire with wine wherever it was burning, and then his brothers and comrades, with many a bitter tear, gathered his white bones, wrapped them in soft robes of purple, and laid them in a golden urn, which they placed in a grave and covered over with large stones set close together. Then they built a barrow hurriedly over it, keeping guard on every side lest the Achaeans should attack them before they had finished. When they had heaped up the barrow, they went back again into the city, and being well assembled, they held high feast in the house of Priam their king. Thus, then, did they celebrate the funeral of Hector, tamer of horses. End of section 24. End of the Iliad by Homer, translated by Samuel Butler.